This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Intuit, the technology platform that brings financial confidence with products like TurboTax, Credit Karma, QuickBooks, and MailChimp. You might have learned the recorder in school, but probably not how to navigate the financial world. Luckily, Intuit's on a mission to help with the free Intuit for Education program. It provides students with the lessons to learn essential skills, like how to build credit, file taxes, and budget. Check out their free resources at intuit.com/education.
In a world of conflict and strife, there is but one fact we all can agree upon. Everybody loves Hugo. Born to humble surroundings, Hugo Reyes has always been a beacon of light for all who crossed his path. Now, Hugo's lifelong love affair with chicken led him to acquire and then expand the Mr. Cluck's chain into a worldwide phenomenon. The exponential growth of Hugo's success was startling. But financial success wasn't the end. It was the beginning. Hugo and giving became synonymous. Parks, playgrounds, hospitals, the Mr. Cluck's house for children. The philanthropy was unparalleled. Which brings us to this evening and the opening of the Hugo Reyes Paleontology Wing at the Golden State Natural History Museum, a lasting beacon of culture that bears the name of one of our city's greatest benefactors. Ladies and gentlemen, our man of the year.
Oh my God, it's an upset and it's a tie. It's Josh Wigler and Mike Bloom. Yeah, that's right. Oh my God, loss is over, but we have to go back down the hatch. It's the Lost Rewatch podcast here on Post Show Recaps, talking season 6, episode 12. Everybody loves Hugo and Mike. Can you believe it? It would seem that everybody loves us too.
I wasn't prepared for this.
You really like us.
Well, I didn't check the reviews recently, so I hope so. There's so many people I want to thank. I want to thank, of course, Count Jacula, DJ Dom, the phrase coming out. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't
for you. Saul, you knew the drill from the beginning.
Absolutely. So thank you.
Oh,
thank you so
God.
Much. I don't know why our trophy is also a dinosaur, but we'll split it up.
Oh, my God.
I'll take the butt because, of course.
What a lovely time. Thank you to everybody who bestowed this prestigious award that we're not entirely sure what it actually
is. So is it a committee decision? Did Pierre Chang single-handedly decide
who
gets it?
I think so. Oh my God. Well, sorry to Hugo Reyes, but everybody loves you anyway, as Lost is over, but we have to go back down the hatch. It's the Lost Rewatch podcast. It's Everybody Loves Hugo, season 6, episode 12, Mike Bloom. And everybody does. Everybody loves Hugo.
Yeah. I mean, listen, look no further than the MVPs to know how much everybody does love Hugo, no matter what universe you reside in. Josh, what realm of afterlife or current life, everybody loves Hugo. It should be noted, this is the last Lost episode proper to focus on just one character. And considering not only how it pairs with Numbers, which I believe Hurley was the last season one character to get a flashback episode, but also where things end up going in the direction of the show feels very apropos.
Yes, absolutely. I think that the sideways intro, at the very least, if not the whole thing, the sideways intro is extremely satisfying to me. When you think about this world as sort of the what came next for these people after their lives, it seems very reflective of a very successful run on the island for Hugo Reyes, Mike.
Well, we talked about this, right, about how this lens of possibly the Flash sideways being viewed as, if the characters created this world, you know, how did they think about themselves and how did they foist that upon their circumstances in this world? And the fact of the matter is, Hugo Reyes made out like gangbusters in the afterlife, right? He's the luckiest man in the world. He's a multimillionaire. Has apparently Mr. Klutz's franchise to the Great Pyramids of Giza.
Mm-hmm.
Even probably one of the... He might honestly, Josh, be like the Elon Musk of the Flash Sideways. And that is a world I want to live in.
That's so odd. What a strange thing. Not everybody loves Elon Musk, but everybody loves Hugo. Everybody,
yeah, Hurley appeared on SNL dressed up as Wario and people loved it.
Everybody loves Elon Cluck.
That's what they call him. They're like, we don't even know what an Elon Musk is, but it feels right to nickname Elon Cluck.
Mr. Cluck. It's really satisfying to see the victory lap for Hurley when you know that he is going to be left in charge of the island by the end of the show, that he is going to be the protector of this place. He's going to be the person who made life better for people once his reign over the island began. And the way that he is sort of feeded here at the start of the episode in the Sideways feels like sort of almost like an epilogue to the show in some ways.
Except for the literal epilogue that we're going to talk about.
Correct. But, you know, it's like an out of place epilogue of sorts that feels, I don't know, really nice. It feels good. I like it. I really, really do. So this is Everybody Loves Hugo. It's a really great Hurley episode. It's, you know, I don't think that you love this episode that much, Mike. I don't want to speak for you.
It's fine. Yeah. Like, it honestly is fine for me. I think I like it more than the other, like, cursed even number episodes we have so far in the form of Recon and The Package. You know, there's some interesting character stuff here, some moderately good stuff. There's some stuff that I really don't like.
Sure.
That I'm sure we'll get into. And the on-island stuff, you know, I think we talked about last week, one of the strengths of Happily Ever After is, like, the small amount of time we spend on the island, and now we get that in droves. This episode that, you know, this very much feels to me like one of those chess pieces episodes, getting everyone, getting the merge to happen at the end here, where Jack ends up staring down John Loki with some character sprinkles thrown on top. So I can't say I absolutely love it, but there are certainly things to appreciate, much like I would say about every season six episode, even the least regarded ones.
I think what you just said, the word merge, is certainly going to be evocative for fans of a certain other island television show known as Survivor. And it is for me as well. And I think it's a really valuable way to kind of look at where we are in the final season of the show, where, you know, we're not talking about the sole survivor necessarily, but we are talking about who will be the final candidate to take over the island and protect this place. That's one thing. And for another, we are going to have the stories collide by the end of this episode, and there's going to be a lot of scrambling along the way. In this one, there will even be whispers in the home stretch. Very Survivor, Mike.
Yes, exactly. It's a live island.
It's a live.
Except, ironically enough, a lot of dead people are the ones doing the whispering.
So I think that there are ways in which the final stretch of Survivor and the final stretch of Lost season six sync up in some ways. And it's not like, you know, it's still not the best run of Lost by any stretch of the imagination. And I think some of the episodes that we're coming up against are more good than great, though I do think that there are going to be some real bright spots still ahead. And I think even bright spots in this one. But this one does feel to me, talked about out of place epilogue qualities about the first scene of this. But I feel in some other ways that this is almost a prologue to the final act of the show. Starting with the last recruit, it really feels like we are finally in the end game of Lost.
Yeah, because we had these two groups separated for a good portion. Really, Dr. Linus, right? That sort of maligned ending by us was those almost its own pseudo-merge with Jack's group coming together with sort of the remnants of the temple. And now, after hanging out on the beach for what feels like forever, now we finally have purpose, albeit it comes at the cost of getting rid of Richard Alpert's first escape plan and Alana alongside it. It really does feel like one of those transition episodes where I think we are phase shifting into what is ultimately going to be the final form of this. Of, okay, Jack has sort of been kept at arm's length from the big bad of season six. Now what happens? It very much has that energy. So again, it's very much like necessary to get them into that place. You mentioned it. This is also an episode that I think ticks. I wouldn't say this was a fairly big mystery, but I think still one of those things that people at least hoped got addressed in season six as to the identity of the Whispers.
I think that the Whispers was a huge mystery. I think that people really wanted an answer to this. And
I'm trying to remember because I feel like it wasn't, the Whispers didn't pop up as of late, right? Like this was one of those season one mysteries to the point where it was the ending of Solitary. But I feel like it had been a while since we've actually had experienced them.
No, we experienced them as recently as the season six premiere, you know, when they're on their way to the temple. How quickly we hope to forget everything that happened there.
Oh, yeah, I think that's why. I think I blocked it from my memory.
But it does, you know.
You're going to have to kiss me, Josh, for me to remember everything at the temple.
Yeah, wake up, Mike. But we do experience the Whispers in relation to the others. And I have talked about how my headcanon for the Whispers is that the Whispers, as explained in this episode, being, as Michael tells us, the ones that can't move on, so effectively ghosts, right, haunting mm-hmm. the island, are in league, are aligned with the others in some capacity, that the others have shown up when the Whispers have manifested. You could either imagine it as the Whispers are showing up to warn our heroes when the others are about to strike, or that the Whispers show up on behalf of the others. It's possible that there's complexity to the Whisper audience, Mike.
Multifaceted ghosts. Some are on the same side.
Some are benevolent, some are not. But I actually think that there are ways to sort of headcanon the explanation that we get here in a way that is satisfying. It's not a problem for me anymore. I used to think that this was very hokey and cheesy and a stupid explanation that flew in the face of the instances of seeing the Whispers that we've had in the past. I don't really feel that way anymore. And in fact, I think that the scenes that we get with Michael and that final scene with Michael, especially, kind of beautiful in certain ways of just the idea of how you could be gone and still be plagued by regret and shame and everything like that. And it adds a little bit of strength, even in my mind, to the final epilogue of the whole show, the new man in charge. That's sort of one of the narrative, the narrative core of that epilogue is Ben and Hurley going to get Walt to bring him to the island because he might be able to help his dad. So I feel like the moment that you get with Hurley and Michael in this episode really stays with Hurley. And as Hurley is trying to figure out what the hell am I going to do now that he's in charge of the island by the end of the show, that this is one of the first items on his to-do list. I think it's kind of nice. So I'm good with the Whisper stuff. What I'm not good with, and in fact I am worse with as time goes on and really hated on the rewatch here, is what they do to Alana. I think it's horrible. I think it's really trashy and shitty. And it is it's especially bad. It comes after, you know, the only other scene we get of Alana in this episode. It's like a really good Alana scene where she's a very kind person to Hurley. She does not deserve to be treated the same way that Damon Lindelof treated his high school science teacher by blowing him up on television.
Ceremoniously. Not even a commercial break to send off Alana. It just cuts to another scene in the middle of the act break.
Yeah, it's really bad. I dislike it, Mike. I dislike it quite a bit. And we'll talk about why once we get to it. We will, of course, unfortunately, have to listen to it as one of the sounds here today. So that's Everybody Loves Hugo, sort of in a nutshell. I think I like this one more than you do. I think that the Hurley and Jack scene that comes up later in the episode is really, really good. I think it's a good Jack episode. I think it's a really great Hurley episode. And I think that it would be, frankly, even higher for me if not for what they do to Alana. I think that that's going to give it a little bit more of a demerit than I even expected leaving last week talking about Happily Ever After and kind of looking ahead towards this one. We're going to start getting into it pretty soon. Of course, you can send your feedback in, folks. We need your feedback. We especially need your star ratings, which you can send to downthehatch@postshowrecaps.com. We're here in the home stretch.
Are they star ratings? I never assumed that they were star ratings.
4.2 stars, I believe, is what we called them. Yeah, 4.2 stars.
So. I just never thought about a quarter of a star, so I guess I haven't really given myself that image yet.
Yeah, percentages of stars. You got to start thinking about it. Is it too late to change it? What do you want to call it now?
Is there another image we should put in there instead, like fish biscuits?
It's way too late for fish biscuits.
Oh, yeah. Well, listen, we're going back to the cages in a couple episodes, so maybe not too late.
Folks, send us your fish biscuits. from a scale of 0 to 4.2 fish biscuits, we want to know, what are your ratings for these episodes, for any episode of Lost? Because while we are in the home stretch of the final season of Lost and the official rewatch of Lost, Down the Hatch is not quite over yet, and we have plans for the other side of season 6, and we need your participation. So please don't be shy. Send them in, your ratings from 0 to 4.2 to Down the Hatch at postshowrecaps.com. It's also the place to send us your feedback. You can also send us feedback by tweeting us at Round Howard, at A Mike Bloom Type. That's me, that's Mike. You can interact with us as well in the Post Show Recaps patron Discord by becoming a patron of Post Show Recaps. Patreon.com/Post Show Recaps. At the $10 level, you get access to the Down the Hatch channel, where you can talk to all your fellow hatchlings about all sorts of Lost related shenanigans. At the $5 level, you get access to the Post Show Recaps campus for the patrons, where we watch Lost on Monday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern is when we are watching new episodes of the rewatch. So coming up next, The Last Recruit is going to be coming your way very soon here on, what is that? That's going to be November 29th at 8 p.m. Eastern in the Post Show Recaps patron campus. Sign up $5 at patreon.com/postshowrecaps to join us for that one, and also to get episodes of Down the Hatch a couple days early. It's another benefit of being a patron of PSR. Mike, let's throw this to our sponsors really quick, a quick ad break, and then we will be back and we will go forth into the jungle to discuss Everybody Loves Hugo. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Tinder. You matched, chatted, vibe checked. Now it's time to meet IRL. So what's stopping you? Tinder is making dating safer and easier with their excellent safety features, like Share My Date, the best way to let your friends know your plans, while Moonlight allows you to discreetly call emergency services, and Are You Sure will prompt people to think twice before sending a potentially harmful message. Explore all of the possibilities for yourself. It starts with a swipe. Download Tinder today.
Yeah, you know you need protein to fuel results, but it's not easy when you're drinking the same bland, chalky shake every day. Stop punishing yourself and get to GNC for the best protein in the game, including all the hottest brands and crave-worthy flavors that'll keep you coming back for more. We're talking protein that legit tastes like cookies, your favorite cereals, indulgent desserts, and more. So bust out of your protein rut and actually look forward to those shakes with unbeatable protein at unbeatable prices. Fuel your fitness with protein at GNC. Yeah.
All right, everybody, let's go forth into the jungle. We're talking about Everybody Loves Hugo, directed by Dan Attias, written by Kitsis and Horowitz. It's another Kitsis and Horowitz jam.
And I believe this is the last one that they singularly work on together. I believe they do What They Died For, but I believe Elizabeth Sarnoff hops on as a third. So I think this is the last proper episode that the two of them are going to write together and only together.
Bon voyage, Kitsis and Horowitz. Once upon a time, we knew ye. So great.
Yeah, and they're probably getting ready, because I believe Once Upon a Time premieres in 2011, so they're probably getting ready to gear up for that one.
They're probably in the gearing up phase, I would guess that's right. It originally airs April 13th, 2010. That's this episode, not Once Upon a Time. When did Once Upon a Time start? Let's see.
Probably the fall of 2011.
Yeah, the fall of 2011.
October 10th.
October 2011 is when Once Upon a Time. So they have like a year before, you know, a little more than a year and a half
October
or so.
October 23rd, Lost number, 2011.
Ooh, wow. That's lovely. So they got some time before they have to start thinking about all the fairy tales of Once Upon a Time. But it's a fairy tale ending.
Happily Ever After was last week, so maybe they had that already burning about in their head.
So it's a fairy tale ending for Hugo Reyes, as here he is, a dead man, getting feted on stage with a Tyrannosaurus Rex trophy. Pretty cool, Mom.
Yeah, so this is a really fun montage. We get some real life Jorge Garcia in here. I'm pretty sure the baby picture is real. I would say, so there's a picture of Hurley with a chihuahua. It turns out it's his real life dog, which is nice, but like, Josh, why isn't a shih tzu? It should be a shih tzu, right?
Can we just headcanon it that in the sideways, chihuahuas are shih tzus?
Is it that weird thing of, well, in this universe, there is no such thing as a chihuahua. It's actually just all dogs are shih tzus.
All dogs are shih tzus in the Flash sideways.
So poor Vincent is going to enter this universe and turn out to be very different from what he once was.
Vincent, but maybe that's what he always wanted to be.
This is also where we find out that Hurley apparently has like an experimental farm, which I found super sort of out of nowhere in the middle of the slideshow.
All of the various things that you find out about Hurley in the slideshow are amazing. So what was the experimental farm that he has in real life? Is that the island is an experimental farm? I feel like that explains the polar bears.
Well, I think you know what it is in the experimental farm. I think in the Flash sideways has got to be for dipping sauces, right? This dude was obsessed with dipping sauces when he was part of Dharma. I think he brought that into the afterlife with him as this chicken magnet.
I think that he may be, he's attracting chickens left and right, this chicken magnet. I think that that's good. I like that. I like that he's been farming for sauces.
Yes, he's the old sauce farmer, and because Hurley's the luckiest man in the world, he hit a pocket of like untouched ranch.
My brain is so diseased at this point, Mike, that I was in my mind thinking, what's the sauce man equivalent of Saul the Drillman? So I came up with Farm the Sauce Man.
Farm the Sauce Man,
which is not a name.
Farm is not a name, but it can be in this world.
Farm would be a good name for something. Farm Wiggler. No. No,
no, because that's more of a command than a person.
Do you think that the farm has anything to do with Ray Mullen and his peaches/pears?
I mean, listen, he wasn't the random mechanic that helped Kate out of her handcuffs. So, like, I would imagine he might have been recruited by Hurley. Maybe the pot farmers that Locke stayed with once upon a time got recruited by Hurley as well. Like, all of the agrarian people that the 815 encountered got kind of schlepped onto Hurley's ranch farm.
Here's Hurley's mother, who is very mad that Hugo does not have a relationship. Women don't love Hugo. Everybody else does, is what she says. You need a woman, Hugo.
Yeah, and this is a fun mirror, because I believe the very first scene we see of her in Numbers, right, is when Hurley comes home from Mr. Klux, and that's what she complains about. I will say, no David Reyes in this does make me question, did he make it into this reality?
No.
Maybe it's just that Hurley only had a plus one, but I would imagine that you, if you're the benefactor, you probably get more than a plus one.
I would think so.
Right?
Maybe it's just Cheech's availability, hopefully. I want to believe that this worked out.
Exactly. Because again, like we talked about last week of like, what does Desmond working for Widmore mean in this universe? If Hurley's there without, you know, his dad that he was able to make up with in the very nice years of his life, if he's not there, what does that say?
What does that say? I don't know. I kind of hope that, David Reyes may have his own baggage that he has to work through before he can wake up, right? He has to work up to being worthy of Hugo and his wife again. So maybe he and Carmen have some kiss in the finale that was cut from the final episode that wakes him up.
Yeah, and then what is it? The image of the two of them bumping uglies in Trisha Tanaka right when Hurley's overhearing it?
Da, 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 da. Thank you.
Oh, no. That's what he says after it comes out, like, oh, thank you.
Thank you. So she's setting him up with a girl named Rosalita. This is a lot.
And also, it is revealed, even though David's out of the picture, it seems like Grandpa Tito's doing well,
good, though,
right? Because I believe it's Grandpa Tito's neighbor's daughter. So unless this is posthumous and Tito has double died.
Good. We're happy about this. On the island, Hurley is talking to Libby's grave. He wonders why she doesn't ever come by.
It's because they hired Cynthia Watros to make the most weird cameos between then and
so
now.
So odd. Yeah, she's the one ghost who never showed up, apparently. She never visits him. But Alana comes by and says, Hurley, we got to get going. We're gonna get dynamite from the Black Rock. We're going to, figure out what's going on with all of that. Richard has the plan. We're going to follow through the plan. But she's not so busy that she cannot stop and ask Hurley, hey, whose grave is this? And Hurley goes on to say, well, this was Libby. We liked each other. We were going to go on a date. It was a picnic. And then she was murdered. And Alana takes a beat and very respectfully says and empathetically says, I'm sorry. And then respectfully leaves to give him some privacy and some space. Alana, stand-up individual.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if this is also like a post-I'll-have-you Alana, right?
Yeah.
Where she's like, you know what, maybe these candidates and other people aren't so bad after all. You know, I might as well take the time to get to know them if I'm supposed to protect them.
Yeah, she's like, well, I'm a character on the show. I should interact with the other characters
for the
on the show.
Like 5 minutes.
Yeah. You know, it's a nice moment. I like it.
I think it's sweet. And, you know, Hurley gets to meet someone new right before he's about to see someone old.
Yes. And so here he is. Michael Dawson shows up. And Michael's only season 6 appearance is this episode. Harold Perrineau coming back one last time. And he's here to stop Hurley from getting everybody killed. Fairly bold, Mike, that Michael would show himself to Hurley. But I guess it makes sense, considering he is somebody who has also blown up, that he would be concerned for other people to blow up as well. Maybe Michael's working theory at this point in time, Mike, is the Whispers are the ones who can't move on and are also the ones who were blown up.
Well, I think it's that you can't move on because all pieces of you have been scattered to the four corners of the world.
It's too hard to assemble. The assembly...
We can't put you back together. Yeah, I actually, the more I think about this with Michael, because initially you think of things like a wink and a nod, right? I'm like, all right, let's bring in Harold Perrineau for the final season. But I think going back to Meet Kevin Johnson and sort of like the moral quandary that Michael faced there back when he thought he was going to blow up a boat of innocent people with that bomb that Ben planted for him, I actually like Michael being the one to express this POV here, right? For him to come through and say, this, it's a catastrophic thing that happens, and I just want you to know like how disastrous it would be if it happens. What I don't love is him basically telling Hurley, if it happens, it's your fault because I warned you.
Right.
Like, that's a little bit of that season 1 and 2 Michael eking through of being a bit rash and a bit blunt. But I think this actually, outside of the cameo, does have connections to the last days of this character back in season 4.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I get that for sure. I think that there's also a piece of it, though, that is maybe Michael trying to light a fire under Hurley's butt, as it were, and, you know, make sure that he's going to do something that's not going to get everybody killed, because Michael can't stand to... If he feels like he knows that this is going to get these people killed, he can't abide having been involved in that again, or standing by and having done nothing. So even if it takes extreme measures to encourage Hurley to action, to inspire him into action, he's gonna take it. I do love that he emerges from the plants.
Oh yes, very true. That's where he comes out of.
Ghost plant, Michael.
I'm trying to remember when he was Kevin Johnson. Was he wearing the same hoodie as what he assumingly is living in purgatory with?
I think that these are his ghost clothes. Yeah, I think that he's wearing the same thing that he wore when he died. I'm pretty sure it's close. I'd have to go back and check, and I'm not going to do that mid podcast right now. But I think that sounds right to me. It looked at least close enough.
Because I would also love if he's, like, relaxing in his ghost recliner. He's like, oh, shit, what's Hurley doing? Man! And he has to, like, get out in his sweats and his hoodie to be like, all right, I'm sorry, I'm not dressed up for the occasion, but you leave me no choice.
Yeah, so he's talking to Hurley, and Hurley is like, you know, Hurley doesn't get super angry all that often. It's not like he's never gotten super angry before, lest we forget the time that he tackled Sawyer into a tent. You know, we've seen this before from Hurley, but this is sort of the more serious, you know, stiffening up of Hurley when he sees Michael. He's like, what are you doing here, dude?
I'm looking at photos now on Lostpedia, and Michael was wearing a button-down shirt when he said, quote, when he saw, quote unquote, Christian Shepherd.
Cool. So he got the ghost hoodie off of the ghost rack.
Yeah, he became... listen, Josh, he became literal Ghost Protocol, so
yes,
I think it makes sense.
Yes. My favorite move. Put up the hoodie. Ghost Protes. We're underway. So we're going to get people... Is it Jack who walks up? Who are you talking to? Her? He's like, nobody?
Yeah. Well, I also... Again, Jack is... Jack's a fantastic wingman in this episode. Like, his attitude at this point is just like, yeah, I'll go wherever, man. And so the fact that he just walks in and asks Hurley, who is he talking to? You know, I think a different form of Jack, which we might talk about in this episode, would be sort of like, Hurley, what's going on with you? Who are you talking to? But at this point, you know, Jack was aware that Hurley had been talking to Jacob. And so he just sort of treats it with a nice nonchalance of, yeah, you do this thing now. It's weird, but it's okay. I'm with the island now. So yeah, who are you talking to? I'm curious.
Yeah. All right. So let's go to the sideways. Hurley's at a restaurant alone eating chips.
Yeah, so we're at Spanish Johnny's, which apparently is a Bruce Springsteen reference. So apologies, I don't have a song parody queued up, but apparently Adam Horowitz is a huge fan of Springsteen as well. So they threw this in here.
That's really fun. Libby shows up. This is not Rosalita. This is not who Hurley thought he was going to meet.
Did Rosalita ever show up, you think? Or do you think Hurley, like, booked it out of there as soon as he saw the Santa Rosa van?
Rosalita is also a Springsteen reference.
Oh, I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, it's a song.
Maybe. Could this be a cameo for Bruce Springsteen to show up?
What is the boss
as Rosalita?
Like, the new boss in charge.
Oh, no, you know what it could have been? It could be like, I want to talk to your boss. These homemade tortilla chips are terrible. And Bruce Springsteen's like, is there a problem here?
Yeah. He comes out. This is what I always wanted to do when I died. So
you get your ass out of here and don't go back to our location on Thunder Road.
Yeah. So it's Libby. And she knows Hurley, but can't exactly explain it. You know, she's holding his hands. It's like, Hugo, do you believe that two people can be connected like soulmates? And Hurley, to his credit, doesn't just stand up and run away, being like,
See, that's
stranger
the thing
danger,
that
stranger danger.
It shows that at least there's some essence of, like, enlightened Hurley here, right? Where Libby says, if I tell you, you're going to think I'm crazy. And he goes, no, I won't. And maybe this speaks to, we talked about this a bit last week, and Libby's going to speak to herself, this idea of just this hankering of, I have no idea who you are, but I feel like I should trust you and confide in you. But yeah. Hugo's a great lending ear for someone who is institutionalized that walked up to him and said, like, I know you from another life.
Yeah, he's pretty steady. And then here comes Dr. Brooks, Senator Kelly himself, Bruce Davidson, returning. Not on my bingo card of people that I expected to see again on Lost by the end of the run, but all right, sure.
Yeah, so I guess we can speak about this more in the conversation with Dr. Brooks, but this was chatted a bit about in the Discord. So, is there some logic here that, much like we talked about with Eloise, that, like, maybe the universe wants to keep these people separated until a particular moment, and maybe Dr. Brooks and Santa Rosa, like, made Libby institutionalized because Hurley wasn't ready yet to wake up from that perspective? Is this more so that just because, assumingly, Libby helped create the universe because she's in the church at the end, that, you know, she decided to put herself in here for whatever reason?
Yeah. I don't know. I really do wish we knew more about Libby, Mike. I gotta say.
Know. Looping back to our, you know, season two conversations.
I really, really do. All of the different times we've brought Libby back, just not to address her history at all, is so odd to me. Yeah, I guess I'm still just good with time traveling, Dave marrying Libby. I have not been presented with a better alternative, Mike.
So speaking of that, because elaborate on that, because how does that, because I know it does factor into the fact that, as Hurley brought up earlier, Libby is the only one who hasn't visited him. Is it less of a trepidatiousness and more that she physically cannot?
Why? Because her body has traveled through time?
I guess so, right? That, like, she has already traveled back and can't be... I mean, we did talk about how ghosts can possibly time travel. I think we talked about that with Charlie, but I wasn't sure with Libby.
Oh, man. Maybe Ghost Libby is saving her appearance to show up in front of the past Libby, who is future Libby, right? When future Libby shows up and meets Hurley on the island, that past Ghost Libby is going to have an it's okay conversation with future Libby. And the ghost, I guess, is even further future Libby.
This is like the end of 12 Monkeys.
It's not really worth doing.
We're in the airport right now, in a different type of airport.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so she's taken back by Dr. Brooks to Santa Rosa in the van.
So they were just going for a trip to Spanish Johnny's.
I don't understand it, honestly. Like, okay, group field trip, Spanish Johnny's.
We're going to, who wants a Mexican?
Yeah, it's just such an odd use of the van for a trip to Spanish Johnny's. But
no, I don't know. I talked about this when we were watching
those loaded
along.
Nachos.
I guess I am fortunate enough that I do not have anyone in my immediate life who did was institutionalized. I never understood the whole, like, voluntarily sign yourself in and out.
It's for, you know, varying degrees of stuff, you know, I think, right. is the point.
I talked about this on the X-Files podcast, actually, several weeks ago. I didn't understand it, where, like, Libby could go, maybe she wanted to go, and everyone's like, oh yeah, could we go with Spanish Johnny's? Dr. Brooks is like, fine, I'll drive the van. I'll be your Miss Frizzle.
No, he probably wanted it as well. How could you resist? So we go back to the island, and the thing happens. Let's listen. Sound one.
All right, let's go. We have to make it to the outriggers and across the channel to Hydra Island before nightfall.
You have the dynamite.
4 sticks. Enough to destroy the cockpit and all the instruments. That plane will never fly.
I don't know if that's a good idea. I mean, for one thing, that stuff's really unstable.
You have to trust me. I've been training my whole life for this.
To blow stuff up.
To protect you.
Yeah, but how is blowing up the plane protecting us?
With that plane gone, that thing won't be able to leave the island.
Yeah, well, neither will we. And then we'll be stuck here with it, and they'll be angry at us.
Jacob said Richard would know what to do. And Richard said to blow up the plane, correct?
Yes.
Well, Jacob never said anything about it to me. I mean, what if Richard's wrong?
Hugo, I'm looking out for your best interest. All of you. Nothing is more important than this. That thing is evil. And God help us if it ever leaves this island.
Because if it's...
And we cut from that to John Loki making a stick. It's not even to commercial.
Nope, not even giving the service of that. I want to couch our discussion in a really interesting comment that Patrick Farrell ended up sending in to us. Straight from the horse's mouth of these two writers. He said, in 2010, I was a sophomore film TV major at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Go Badgers? I don't know. I can't remember what the mascot is.
Oh, my God.
Shortly after the airing of Everybody Loves Hugo, I had the opportunity to attend a guest lecture by Lost writers and UW alum Edward Kitsis and Adam Horowitz. Since they had written Everybody Loves Hugo, one person asked them directly why Alana had to die. They didn't want to spoil anything and were very careful with their words. They started explaining it by contrasting her with Frank. They said most of the writers really gravitated toward Frank in the final episodes because his backstory was so uncomplicated. I was supposed to fly 815 that day. Why didn't you? I overslept. The end. They implied that Alana was on the other end of that spectrum. They couldn't tell her backstory, they'd have to show it, which would take a time away from the original 815ers who fans cared more about. They also hinted that where things were going, have Alana around would make things too easy for the characters and sacrifice narrative stakes. This, honestly, Josh, reading this really made me angry.
Talk to me
really
about why. Articulate it.
Because, honestly, then what they're saying is, for lack of a better term, laziness. That's literally what they're saying. They're saying, oh, there were two paths here. There was the Occam's Razor, where we keep Frank Lapidus around because you could just throw him in for a couple lines and we don't have to explain anything. Or there's this character that we created that had this complicated, mysterious backstory that we chose not to introduce, and we realized that it was too complicated, so we had to kill her off. It's just, these people have created such wonderfully woven tapestries of stories and narrative, and they choose to give up now. They choose this to be the thing that they are going to shunt off writing when we have a storyline of Sun being unable to speak English. Yeah. That gets more dedication. It's ridiculous to me, like the sacrifices that they choose to make here. And look, the moral of the story is, if you felt that you couldn't write for the character, don't make the goddamn character.
I think that that's the biggest thing for me, because I've been thinking about what could they have done better with Alana, and I almost feel like maybe the best outcome was to not create the character in the first place, but I feel like that's a little unfair to Zuelka Robinson, who I think does a really good job with the character. I felt that way on this pass through, that I think that she imbues Alana with a lot of strength, vulnerability, complexity. Her first couple of episodes in season 5 are maybe not super great, but I think that in season 6, she's good. I really like her. I don't think that they were... We didn't need to know much more about Alana other than she's an agent of Jacob. And if she somehow survives long enough to make it to what they died for, and everybody is seeing Jacob there, then she can have like a moment with him that could be like kind and sweet. And she can then just be another like helpful part of the final push, whether that's she's surviving with the candidates or she's with Frank and Richard and Miles for the final push of the end and somehow sees like young Jacob over there. That could have been kind. That could have been sweet. There were some suggestions when we were watching this live of, well, what if Alana dies in the submarine? Okay, sure. You know, that could work too. Maybe she could be the person who runs the bomb out instead of Saeed and does this last thing to protect the candidates. There's a lot to potentially chew on in terms of ways that she could have died that would have had more meaning. I am, you know, I am not sure what the proper answer is, but I know what the wrong answer is, and it's what they did here, that they threw their hands up. They're like, this is too hard to explain. Let's just kill her off. It'll be evocative of season one, and we're doing a lot of that right now. This feels like one of maybe a weird one to say this is one of your least favorite and most problematic parts of the final season, but it is for me. I think it's really representative of,
yes,
you were talking about Sun and the speaks English storyline making its way here into the final season. But just think about a lot of the wheel spinning of a lot of the sideways stories and the meandering of the plot in a lot of season six, and just the real estate that is sort of squandered. We don't get the Claire episode. You don't get the Alana episode. It's not even that you necessarily have to get those things, but there are opportunities here to dig deeper into some of these characters than we do in the final season, to challenge them, to challenge us, instead of just randomly blowing them up for actually no reason other than to remind us that the Black Rock dynamite is volatile and to send us back to feeling like, oh God, it was shocking when Dr. Arst blew up. But that was funny, and that was played for laughs and shock value, and the fact that it happened to a character that you didn't feel horrible about it happening to made it all of those things, made it a memorable, entertaining television event that you just don't forget. With Alana, it feels unnecessarily cruel, and I think, to use your word, it does feel lazy. It feels like a surrender, a white flag. It feels like a real misjudgment of the character and where we as the audience are with her. I don't think that anyone is blaming where we are in season six on Alana the way that people may have been blaming some of where we are in season three on Nikki and Paolo, for instance. Mm-hmm. It's just wretched. I really dislike it. This is the stuff, you know, when there's, you know, people who love the show, talk about why they don't like the final season. I think it's really easy to broad brush the complaints about the final season as, well, people just didn't like how it ended and people didn't understand. And like, I just rewatched the end the other day, and I watched it on Monday morning. It was way too early in the day to be bawling uncontrollably the way that I was.
Never too early.
The podcast will be difficult to record.
It's cry o'clock somewhere,
it's,
Josh.
It's going to be really tough. So for me, the end is exceptional. It's really, really great. My issue has nothing to do with that. My issue has to do with the missed opportunities with characters and real estate of the final season. And I don't think that it's fair to say that if you didn't like the final season, it's only because you didn't like or understand the sideways. I don't think that that's fair at all. And I think Alana is a real avatar of that for me.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I'll be quite frank, not Lapidus, even though they cited this character. I think if any Lost writer uses an excuse in the final season of we didn't have time, that is absolute bullshit, in my opinion. Because like you said, they had 18 episodes, to the point that you made before of how some of these episodes feel like they were actually just sort of hanging out, waiting for certain landmarks to hit. Exactly. So the fact that they said, well, we're sorry, we didn't have enough time to squeeze it in, and some of the stuff they did choose to keep in, it just doesn't really register for me. So yeah, suffice it to say, like, thank you for sending that in, but that was something that I think makes me even madder at the choice here. Not only to mention, as we mentioned before, the way it's actually done on the show is not good. They just shrug it off and do away with it. We're eventually going to come back and deal with the repercussions of that. But in the moment, they're just sort of like, and she blows up, moving on.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I don't even know why I feel the need to say this, but obviously we love the show. We would not be doing this if we didn't love the show. We would not be making plans for what to do after the rewatch if we did not love the show. We love the show. We adore the show. These characters are family in many ways. The island is
family.
Home in
family.
Many ways. You
family.
Know?
Family. Have you seen that viral tweet, Josh, of all the guys dressed up like Vin Diesel and just saying family over and over again?
No, I haven't. But that's how I feel. These people are home to me. This is my favorite show. So these complaints can exist with that feeling. And you can say to your child at the end of the day when they come home from school and they did something wrong in school and you got called about it, that I'm very disappointed in you. You could say that and still love your child. And I'm very disappointed in Lost with the way that they handle Alana. And I think that it is the thing that I would point to more so than any sideways scene as to what my issues with the final season are.
Yeah. And then we cut from that to, I think, something that is a little bit also of a microcosm of what I don't love about season six, which is, as Sawyer vocalizes, the fact that Camp John Loki has just been sitting there doing nothing, doing Jack Shepherd all for the past little while, right? They got, like, tranked a couple of episodes ago, then they just sort of came back to life, and now they're just waiting on orders. But unlike John Locke, who gets zapped away before he can give orders in the beginning of season five, John Loki's got nothing for you, to use another piece of Survivor parlance.
Nothing for you. So he's got nothing. He's been making this stick this whole time. And Saeed has returned. He has returned with Desmond, and he is going to take John Loki to him to have a conversation that we will check in on a little while from now. Meanwhile, on the other side of Alana's explosion, Richard is trying to wrangle the group together, and he's saying, we need to go back to the Black Rock and get more dynamite, or else Alana died for nothing.
All right, so this is perhaps the biggest revelation I had about this episode. And it sincerely blew my mind, like Alana chunks all over the 815 camp. I realized, at least in this episode, because I honestly don't remember much about Richard's arc for the rest of the series, but Richard Alpert has such big early season Jack Shepherd energy in this episode, Josh.
Tell me more about that.
It's incredibly interesting to me, because this entire time, Richard is going to be very vocal, right? He's going to be headstrong. He's going to be very stubborn. He keeps pushing this dynamite plan. Eventually, he's going to split away from the group, because he is that you know, set in his ways. He is going to, you know, actively oppose people like Hurley and Jack, who are more so connected with the island in a way that Jack would. I mean, quite literally, so we saw Isabella's cross that Richard put on in Abiterno. This, I believe, is the first episode that cross is missing. So it really is almost like Richard Alpert took off his Richard Alpert outfit and put on his Jack Shepherd outfit. I think the way that Richard engages with the group and really tries to take that leadership role to be like, all right, especially now that Alana's gone, we've got to keep going. We got to keep going for dynamite, and doing it in a brusque way, I think really harkens back to those early days of Jack, right? Where he's like, I don't want to do this, but somebody has to. So I guess I'm the one giving out orders here.
Yeah. I love that. I think to me, he's maybe a little more cracked out than Jack was in season one. There's sort of a wild energy to Richard here, where he gets like so angry and animated about it. And Jack was kind of stoic, is certainly my memory of early Jack. But I think that you're right otherwise about sort of the defiance, the inability to listen to anybody else, or lack of interest in listening to anybody else, or the self-assuredness and certainty that he is on the right. Even after having a moment of, you know, sort of bonding with Hurley, he's going to be very anti-Hurley in this episode, which I think is also yet another maybe demerit in Richard's column. We're going back to that because Hurley is clearly going to be the leader of this place, and Richard, who spent all of those years being the lieutenant to all of these leaders, can't see that Hurley is the guy who should be calling the shots. But I think that that's great. I think that that's really fun, this idea of Richard sort of taking on the Jack role, as Jack is, as he's going to say, actively resisting doing his normal Jack stuff.
Yeah, which is, again, very fun, because it's this idea almost like, spoiler alert for The Wire. If you haven't seen this incredible show, please tune ahead about 30 seconds to a minute. It very much reminds me of that, right? When the ultimate lesson is, like, even those in power that leave, someone else steps in their place and the cycle repeats itself. We get it a little bit here, where in the absence of John Locke, Jack has stepped into his place, but, like, there's almost always going to be a natural opposition to that force, and so Richard has kind of become the man of science in his place. I think it's just a very fun character note that, again, I'm not sure if it's going to live outside of this episode, but at least in this episode, the way, and especially the way that Richard separates from Jack in a way that much like Jack separated from Locke in another Hurley episode. I think it's very fun to watch.
Yeah, I definitely think so as well. I love Hurley in this episode so much where he's like, oh yeah, no, Richard's right. Jack, we gotta do what Richard wants us to do. It's the right choice. Do you trust me, Jack? And Jack's like, okay, Hurley. Yeah, I trust you.
Yeah. The fun thing about Jack as well is that he knows that Hurley is sort of lying through his teeth this entire time. Because say what you want to about Hurley as a character, the dude still can't lie for beans. And so it's going to become a much bigger moment later where he claims that Jacob's right there telling him what to do. But like, I would imagine in this moment when Hurley's saying, oh, we have to go to the Black Rock and assist Richard, Jack's like, all right, you're up to something, Hurley, but I'm with you. No matter what.
He doesn't need to know. Doesn't need to know. In the flash sideways, following meeting Libby, Hurley has gone to one of his very own Mr. Cluck's locations to get a bucket of family-style fried chicken to the face.
And we need to talk about this cameo, because this is not obviously like a special guest thing, but Josh, a semi-famous face, especially I think to you and I in our proclivities towards movies, shows up here as the clerk.
Yeah. It's Sam Levine.
Sam Levine, a.k.a. Artie the Beekeeper from What Hot American Summer, probably most famously well known as Neil. Is that his character name from Freaks and Geeks?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so here he shows up as like the erstwhile amiable clerk at Mr. Cluck's. And it was one of those Leonardo DiCaprio moments of like, oh, that guy. Yeah, he's here. I don't know if he was like a fan of Lost or if he just randomly got cast in this, but fun to see him make an appearance as a day player.
Yes, really fun. This is the sort of cameo that I can get behind because it's fast.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Really quick.
Not spend an entire episode on, you know, on the EPA guy from Ghostbusters being the main antagonist.
No, I think that's good. So Hurley's going to sit down with the chicken witch, by the way. I should mention, I'm on a diet right now. This looks so good. All I want to do is eat the full bucket of chicken to the face. I'm so in Hurley's headspace right now that I would eat, I would crush my feelings in this fried chicken basket right now.
That's the thing. I don't know. Maybe I'm not a big KFC guy in terms of like getting that type of fried chicken. I don't know if I'd get the bone in.
Oh, I totally would. I totally would. 100%.
I think I have fears about that. Like, I know that the boneless probably has more suspect circumstances as to what's in it, but like, I'd rather dig into that than have to worry about bones eating some Mr. Cluck's.
I'd go all the way, and I would do exactly what Hurley is doing right now, and I cannot wait until the day that this happens for me. Ideally, not in the afterlife, though I guess if I'm eating fried chicken in the afterlife, something went right. Anyway, Desmond, recently woke, is going to pay Hugo Reyes a visit here at Mr. Cluck's to try and push him along to do the same thing for Hurley as Charlie did for Desmond. Let's listen in. Sound number two.
What?
I'm sorry. Have I seen you before?
I own the place. Maybe you saw my commercial. You want to click it to your keychain?
No, it's not that. Were you on Oceanic Flight A15 about a week ago from Sydney?
Yeah.
So was I.
Wow, what a coincidence.
Yeah, listen, you mind if I join you while I wait for my order?
You my guest.
That is a lot of chicken.
I eat when I'm depressed.
Ah. So what's her name?
I met a girl on a blind date the other night.
And you didn't go how you'd hoped.
Mm. She's totally awesome. Except for one thing. She's crazy.
Well, all women are a little bit crazy, brother.
No, this one actually lives in the loony bin. I mean, I saw the van. She's full on nuts. I mean, she started saying, but then she told me that we already knew each other. And that, I'd remember.
Tell me something. Did you believe her when she said she knew you?
Yeah. Kinda.
No, I say go with your gut. Now, maybe you should try to find out where she thinks she knew you from before you give up on her.
42? Order 42?
That's me, brother. Well. It was nice bumping into you.
Let's compare this nudge from Desmond to later when he runs over John Locke with his car.
Yes, okay. It's a big extreme.
it's very much a huge, different size of the spectrum.
Huge swing. It's very, very different.
Absolutely. I just think it's really interesting that, like, you think it's a gradual scale, right, where Desmond has this new mission. And this is very nice of him giving the very gradual nudge. Also, you know, having one of the most romantic characters in the show be, like, chase after her. Very Desmond-esque. And then he runs over someone with his car.
He's just
going
to hit Locke with a car. The Desmond in the Flash sideways trying to wake people up stuff is so much more complicated than it needs to be. To Hurley, a gentle nudge. To John Locke, of the full force of his four-wheeled apparatus is crazy. Yeah. It's crazy.
Maybe this is like the result of him not having much guidance, right? Maybe that's the sort of the Jacobian elements of it all. Jacob doesn't give instructions to people and they go wild trying to interpret his words. Desmond just had this inkling of, okay, I need to help them, but nobody told him how, so he's just wildly making swings and hoping they connect.
Yes. So he's giving him that little push to go and investigate the situation further on his own. I guess that's going to work out, you know? That's going to work out for Hurley and Desmond. But we follow Desmond out of the sideways, which I think is interesting as a choice.
Yeah.
I guess we're doing more of that as things are starting to... The cosmic gumbo is starting to blend together, Mike. It's a cosmic gumbo, is what we called it on set. John Loki and Desmond are going to have the conversation. Where he's like, well, why haven't you run? I've got nowhere to run to, brother.
If Desmond's tied to a tree, and he's like, all right, jungle I'm not going to give peace to you.
Yeah. And I love this from Loki when he says, wow, if I have nowhere to run is not the best argument against captivity, then I don't know what it is.
See, this it's an interesting episode for John Loki, because this is where we begin to see shades of the guy that existed through the first bunch of episodes in season 6. And that's because Desmond still believes that he's John Locke. And so it's almost like, oh, I get to play this game again. Okay, I'm a little rusty, but this is fun. It should also be noted, we talked about this Desmond-Saeed scene at the end of Happily Ever After, how both of them are, like, not intoxicated, but definitely not acting in the way that they usually do. I sort of realized that I think in this episode, Desmond's almost acting like a child. Like, he has the naivete and innocence and, like, jovial nature of a child to naturally trust in someone like John Locke. That's very much the attitude I get from Desmond. So I think John Loki sees Desmond and gets the knife and unties him and says, like, oh, okay, this'll be fun. I get to, you know, pull out one last trick one more time, because with everyone else, I decided to somehow come up with this weird duplicitous reasoning of how I'm not the smoke person, but I am the smoke person.
Do you think that, so when he asks, do you know who I am? And Desmond goes, of course I do. You're John Locke. Do you think he believes that?
I would imagine so, because of the same logic that Ben used at the end of season 5, of this idea of Desmond thinking that anything on the island is possible, right? This is a guy who spent 3 years there. So I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility, especially considering, like, the reason why he's back. If he is indeed all in on the island isn't done with you, and he seems very devoted to the cause, I think it would make sense if he's just like, oh yeah, he's alive. He got brought back to life. Yeah, that totally makes sense. Which, again, is the wrong thinking, much like it was for Ben. But I could see it logically from Desmond's perspective, considering everything he's seen. Like, theoretically, Desmond should be dead, and he's alive. So I think he can just sort of look at John Locke and say, oh yeah, that's the box man, I know him, and then be done with it.
I mean, it makes some sense as to why he followed Saeed with no problem. He's like, oh, Saeed, that's my guy. And he would be here with John Locke. He'd be like, oh, John Locke, box man, that's my guy. You know,
I am sad that Desmond did not get a hello yourself box man in.
It would have been nice. You know, we're talking about the types of nods that the final season does to previous instances of character interactions on Lost. That would have been good. But I do love the, of course, you're John Locke. Is great. And Loki's reaction to that being like, oh God, yes, 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 yes. I've got him exactly where I want him. And he's going to end up throwing him down a well, which I gotta tell you, still don't fully understand why he does that instead of just outright killing him if Desmond's not a candidate, but whatever. Okay. So Ben is with Jack, and
we should also note here, because you skipped over it understandably. So there is a small scene where Hurley goes through Alana's stuff. Apparently, this was a pickup scene. They filmed it, I believe, while they were filming What They Died For, another Kitsis Horowitz joint. Maybe it's because they, like, I don't know, wanted to somehow commemorate Alana in some way. But yeah, if the Hurley going through Alana's stuff scene just randomly comes out of nowhere, that's why.
Yeah. So they're walking through the jungle. This is where Ben starts to remark that Alana had been trained by Jacob. And no sooner does she tell you who you are and what you're here for that she blows up. The island was done with her. What's going to happen when it's done with us?
And it should also be noted, Sun's just here. Because remember, she still can't speak English.
Can't say anything.
So she's just hanging out with Jack and Ben, having this very, like, ominous conversation about what happens when the island's done with you.
Yeah. He he's probably concerned about himself, rightfully so.
Yeah.
Alana was kind of keeping him alive, is probably his view of things. So he's probably a little nervous.
And he also thinks that maybe this is a representation of the island being like, oh, Ben, you thought you were remorseful, but we're still not on your side.
Yeah.
Right? You still have several demons to slay. So we reach the Black Rock. And again, let's put this in the Venn diagram of Richard and Jack Shepard circa season one. Richard says, only I will take the dynamite.
Yeah.
Richard Alpert would definitely switch it out for Kate so that when she gets sucked down the monster tube that, like, he reveals that he actually had the dynamite the entire time.
Yes. So Richard's like, where's Hugo? And we just cut to go, 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 because Hurley blows up the GDBR. The goddamn Black Rock is gone.
How did he? Did he just sneak by them while they were all congregating, taking a water break or something? He went in the back entrance.
No idea, and I don't really care. This is one of those things that it is so much more fun to see the aftermath than the process.
Yes.
This is like, I don't need to see every single thing that Batman does, even though that would be fun to, you know, do a ride along in the Batmobile with Bruce. I just want to see, like, him, you know, grab bad guys and pull them into the shadows. Here's her. Early getting that kind of treatment, and I think it's really, really fun.
Yeah, and it's also fun to watch him, you know, do the whole action movie thing. I mean, we should also say RIP Black Rock, and this is officially the end of a landmark that, as we talked about in Abiturno, maybe the number one place in terms of, like, overall quality of scenes. There are so many great scenes that take place in the Black Rock. It has to be the number one.
Yeah. I'm really bummed about its demolition, Mike, because it is such a great set. The first part of me is sad because when Lost is inevitably rebooted, the Black Rock is canonically destroyed. But then there's another part of me that gets very excited about the fact that in the inevitable Lost sequel, there's an opportunity to have a literal ghost pirate ship in the form of the Black Rock.
But what you don't know is in the Flash sideways, there's a deleted scene where Hurley, as Elon Klux, makes his own spaceship that he calls the Black Rock.
Oh, God, a Black Rocket.
Yeah, Black Rocket Man.
Yeah, there he goes. So he blew it up. He destroyed it. It's gone. And Richard's pissed. Then Miles even says, a warning would have been nice.
Yeah, and Richard's also, like you said, sort of the manic aspect of him is he just keeps repeating, like, we're all dead. We're all dead.
Yeah.
We're all dead.
Yeah.
Like, he is very much trying to think and sort of using these filler words of, oh, God, oh, no, that was my only plan. What happens now?
You know what's funny is in that way, it's almost like he's Jack and Hurley combined. Because that's sort of classic. Oh, God, we're dead. Oh, geez. Sort of the indecision paralysis, I think, is kind of here on Richard right now as well.
Yeah, that's really fun. And so, you know, this is also a really interesting scene between Hurley and Miles.
Yeah.
Right? Where Hurley tells Miles about Michael talking to him. Miles doesn't recognize Michael. Like, should Hurley have said, oh, it's Kevin Johnson? And Miles like, oh, yeah, I talked with that guy.
If he knew Kevin Johnson, I think maybe it would be different. I don't know if it ever came up during the Dharma years. Probably. I would guess that,
they
have time to talk about everything.
And I'm pretty sure Miles was there in the room in season four when Ben said Michael was the man on the boat.
Right. Right, but he still maybe doesn't totally know.
It's also Miles, right? Like, this might be the Sawyer S streak in him, like, never heard of the dude.
Sure, for sure. But I love this. Does it happen to you often that ghosts come and tell you what to do? And Hurley says, often enough. And Miles says, and you always do what they say? And Hurley effectively says, yeah, because dead people are more reliable.
Yeah, it's a sad statement, but, like, not untrue, right? Ghosts don't necessarily have, for lack of a better term, protocol. Maybe in the case of Michael, they do, but they have no reason to be duplicitous to you, necessarily. So Hurley, I think, has such, like, a a rock bottom faith in humanity at this point. He's like, honestly, the people that are dead don't have any rationale to lie to me. So yeah, I guess they are more trustworthy by default.
Yeah. So when we go to the sideways, Hurley's going to come to Dr. Brooks and say, hey, can I take Libby out on a date? And Dr. Brooks goes, oh, well, I don't know about that. He's like, well, what if I give you $100,000? And Dr. Brooks says, sure.
Yeah, Dr. Brooks has a really odd sort of temperament in this. Like, Libby has issues with reality. It would not be a good idea to see each other, which, again, maybe factors into this idea of, you know, the universe trying to keep them apart. Let's talk about, I mean, I guess we'll talk about with Libby waking up. Like, was she institutionalized when she woke up? Did she wake up and then institutionalize herself?
Oh, interesting. That's interesting.
That could be, because that's, you know, why Hurley sends himself back to Santa Rosa, right? Is because he was seeing Charlie's ghost and was like, okay, I gotta send, like, clearly something's wrong with me.
I think that makes a lot of sense. She, like, saw that and she's like, I gotta go check in somewhere.
Yeah, like, clearly I'm not well.
Yeah. I think that tracks. I like that. I think that's good. Is it ethical for Dr. Brooks to have accepted this donation for this purpose?
No, absolutely not. This is bribery. This is
rhetorical.
This is a crime.
Yeah.
This is an actual crime that's being done.
Yeah, it's a crime. He's doing a crime. Hurley's doing a crime. Are we going to be mad at Hurley for doing this crime?
Yeah, but that's also an ends justifies the means type of thing. Though, I mean, listen, Santa Rosa was never the best from an infrastructure perspective, so I guess it is helping. And of course, gotta love that circa 2000s way of portraying a mental institution of, like, somebody in the corner touching the wall, someone spinning around in circles, that picture-perfect quality of mental health.
Yeah, I don't like Dr. Brooks, so he'll be the one that I blame for this.
Yeah, it seems like he's the one quite literally in charge of the asylum, so I think we saddle him with any blame.
So Hurley comes and sees Libby. Sadly, no Leonard in the background. That would have been nice.
We do get the Connect Four, but yeah, no Leonard.
The Connect Four connection. So he sits across from Libby. He has not remembered her, and she's not sure where she knows him from, but she was watching TV and then was flooded with all these memories of seeing Hurley in another life with a plane crash and the island. We knew each other. We liked each other. And when I'd gotten here, it was like I had been here before. So she's basically, you know, she's not fully woken up, Mike, but she had, I guess, sort of maybe that first phase that Desmond has before he meets Penny.
Or what Charlie did, right? We're like,
right, yes, that's better. That's more accurate.
Person of, she's important. I don't know why, but I really care about this person. We're like, it's almost like sleep paralysis, where part of you is awake, but part of you isn't. So, like, when she approached Hurley, it was not in a full thing of, oh, you're Hugo Reyes. We met in this time, and doing laundry meant something different. She very much is like, I know you from somewhere, and I'm not sure. This is a really sweet scene. I miss the chemistry that these two actors had, but, you know, when Libby says, I'm crazy, and Hurley says, yeah, probably, but we've all got something, right? Like, just such great Hurley energy. Jorge Garcia, of course, does a great job whenever he's given the spotlight, and this episode's no different.
When he says, it takes guts to tell a stranger you're from an alternate universe. I'm scared to say hi to a girl, and she says, you're doing fine. I love that interaction a lot. I just think it's very, very, very sweet. So he asks her out on a date. She says, yes, we will follow up on that in a little while. John Loki and Desmond are walking on their way to the well. This is just a very brief pit stop that on their way to the well, they see young Jacob. Desmond can see young Jacob.
He hasn't popped up since the substitute. I don't think he's visited his brother since the substitute. So it's clear that, like, whenever he's appearing to his brother, he's appearing as Kid Jacob, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's
just
right.
Just to, like, taunt him.
Yeah, and so he says, disregard the boy. Disregard that boy. We are now going to get into a series of scenes that shall mark the remainder of our sounds for this episode, a very back half sound heavy episode of Lost, Mike. So let's start here with Richard Alpert is going to finally start speaking in full sentences instead of just grumble, grumble, death, we're going to die, and try to make his pitch as to what they should do next. And Hurley will make his own. This is almost evocative, Mike, of the season 4 premiere of Taking Sides.
Very much so. But now Hurley, Jack is the Hurley and Hurley is the Lock.
Yes. So let's see who we should follow. Let's listen in sound 3.
Where are you going?
Stan, get back to the Dharma Barracks.
You still grenades here?
Explosives? Yes, I think so.
Then that's where we're going.
Maybe we should talk about this a minute.
Talk? There's no time to talk. But if you know what we need to do, you know how we stop that thing from leaving the island without blowing that plane up, then let's hear it. Let's all hear it.
I know what we need to do.
Really? What's that?
We have to go talk to Locke.
Are you trying to get us killed?
It's not my idea. It's his. Jacob says we have to talk to Locke.
Jacob's here right now?
Yeah.
Ask him what the island is.
What?
A while back, Jacob told me what the island was. If he's really standing here right next to me, then just ask him.
I don't have to prove anything to you, Richard. You can either come with me, or you can keep trying to blow stuff up. Your call, dude.
He's lying. Jacob isn't telling us what to do because Jacob never tells us what to do. I'm going to make this simple. If that thing leaves the island, that's it. It's over.
What's over?
Everything. I'm destroying that plane. And I can use all the help I can get. Who's coming with me?
I am.
I saw that thing in action, man. It doesn't want to talk. Sorry.
Anyone else?
Sorry, Richard. Jacob says we go talk to Locke, we go talk to Locke.
I'm going with Hugo.
Really?
Don't get in our way.
All right, Hurley. Let's go talk to Locke.
I can't remember if we said this during the beginning of the end, but is it wrong for me to be on both of their sides here?
Well, it doesn't sound like it's a total either or, right? You know, Hurley's going to go one way and Richard and his team will go the other, and their agendas are not necessarily in conflict with each other. It's just that for Hurley's own survival, he feels that going towards Locke is going to be the right call, that getting to confront him directly and start dealing with this in a more direct way is going to be the better path than trying to sabotage their way off the island. So I think that there's ways in which both of these people are, I don't know about talking total sense, but they're not like in complete, absolute antagonistic opposition with each other.
Not to mention, Richard Alpert does call Hurley out on his bullshit.
Yeah, right? He gets like, him right. Yeah, he reads it. He reads it correctly.
He completely clocks him of like, no, you're completely making this up. And I think also, to him, understandably so, Hurley's plan is a little ridiculous, right? That's why Miles ends up going with them, is because he's like, I saw this dude turn into a smoke monster and murder several people at a temple. I don't know if he's going to talk, so good luck signing your death warrants, people. I'm not going there. So, again, I think all these characters are all justified in the various perspectives that they take here.
Yeah, I think so as well. I do like that kind of threat from Richard of, you know, don't get in our way. What was he going to do? What if they did?
I'm not sure. Blow them up?
Yeah.
If he gets the grenades?
He just throws C4 at them.
But again, that's very much a Jack thing, right? Like, when Locke threw the knife in Naomi's back, Jack was going to shoot him.
He was ready.
The gun wasn't loaded. So.
He was ready to do it. He for sure would have done.
Again, very, very similar temperament here.
Yeah, absolutely. Any thoughts on the division of people, of Ben and Miles, Team Richard, and then everybody else, Team Hurley?
I mean, Son and Frank don't know Richard from a hole in the ground, right? I guess Son and they had some time with him, I suppose, back in the shadow of the statue, but like, I'd imagine they trust in Hurley and especially Jack a lot more than Richard Alpert and especially Ben.
I think Frank is the one that I'm maybe somewhat confused by, But then I thought about it a little bit more and thought about how he probably isn't going to be emotionally equipped to watch them blow up a plane.
That's true. Like, get me away from that plane. If I'm flying it, perfect. If you're destroying it, that's ripping out a chunk of my heart.
Yeah. So he just like can't handle that. So the group is divided. And later that night, as they're walking, Sun asks Frank if they made a mistake. And she does that on paper.
Because she can't speak English.
Not until next week.
Just a reminder, everybody, that thing's still going. Poor Youngjin Kim had to go there and shoot these scenes.
For the rest of her storyline.
Yeah, and just stood around the entire time.
Other than one more episode, basically. You know, she'll have a couple of lines in English next week. And then she won't be able to speak for much longer than the candidate because she'll be dead. Still too soon. Hurley and Jack are going to have a conversation that I love. Let's listen in. Sound 4.
So what do you think we should say to Locke when we get there? I mean, how do you break the ice with a smoke monster?
Don't worry about it. Something tells me he's going to do most of the talking.
But he could just kill us all.
Yeah, he could.
I didn't see Jacob back there.
I just said it because I want everyone to listen to me.
Why'd you come with me?
Ever since Juliet died. Ever since I got her killed. All I've wanted was to fix it. But I can't. I can't ever fix it. You have no idea how hard it is for me to sit back and listen to other people tell me what I should do. But I think maybe that's the point. Maybe I'm supposed to let go.
Unless you letting go gets us killed. Going to see Locke was my idea, not Jacob's.
Early, you asked me to trust you. This is me trusting you.
It's a good thing you do, dude, because I have no idea where I'm going.
Wait. It's cool. I think I know what these things are.
Oh, yeah. What the hell are they?
Wait here.
I think it's abundantly clear through this conversation that what Jack Shepard needed the most in those 3 years off island was therapy.
Yeah.
This was a therapy session, essentially,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, everybody would benefit from it, is my feeling.
Absolutely.
But it's obviously not a possibility for everyone, which sucks. But for Jack, it was definitely a possibility. He had the health insurance, no doubt. And the money, because he got the Oceanic settlement. And he was probably doing just fine before that. Anyway. But yes. Definitely. And Jack definitely at this point has been therapized by life to some extent. You know, he has been through some brutal stuff. He came back here and dragged everybody here, you know, in no small part thanks to ego. You know, thinking like, we need to be here. I need to be here. And the only way is to drag all of you back here. So I'll do that. That wasn't really good. You know, the instinct to come back and to that there was work to be done here was not wrong. But, you know, he was not in a pure place to do that. And I don't know that he ever gets to a fully pure place. I do still think that a lot of it is about, you know, trying to, you know, it's not an altruistic thing altogether what Jack does over the course of the final episodes of this show. But I think that there is a sense of self-awareness and reflection on who I am and who I have been and who I could possibly be that is at play here. And one of the things that is efforting him towards a better version of himself is taking time to not have to shot call and instead just trust that his friend who he loves and knows and believes in can pull something off, and to, you know, rely on a person other than himself. That itself is such a difficult act for somebody of Jack's makeup. In its own way, just the sheer act of Hurley, I trust you, and you've got this, and I will do what you say, is, you know, something of a small victory.
I really love the small gesture, but speaks volumes, when Jack starts his speech and he says, ever since Juliet died, ever since I got her killed.
Yes, that's a huge correction.
Yeah, very huge correction, because one is passive, one is arguably aggressive, or at least blaming yourself for it. And it's a big admission as well, right? We talked about how Jack was sort of in this odd stasis the first few episodes of season six, where he was wrong about the incident, and Juliet died, and he is riddled with this, but he didn't actually talk about it until this moment, and I think that is therapeutic of its own. They say, you know, once you give your fears and issues a name, that sort of eliminates it. It makes it weaker to actually talk about your fears, to actually put them out there in the universe instead of letting them fester away in your brain. And that's what Jack is doing here. Like, he is admitting, yeah, I got her killed, and it's terrible, and I live with it every day of my life. But I've realized that what I've been working towards is this, like, untenable solution to fix all that. And it got someone killed. And that's not the way that I need to do things. It's not healthy. It never was. Let me try something different and see if that works.
Yeah. I think it's really nice. I think it's a great interaction between him and Hurley. And I just love the interaction from Hurley of, I'm glad you believe in me because I have no idea what I'm doing. It's just sort of, you know, the last remnants of his fear here, I think are very relatable.
And also this idea, right, that I think Hurley has always felt, and this will, you know, go to the end when Jack abdicates leadership to Hurley, and Hurley's like, me, no, I'm not ready. And it's this idea of like, no, you were ready the entire time. Where Hurley says, oh, no, I made up that Jacob went this way. Like, it's very clear that Hurley has kind of lived his lives being guided by people, whether off island it was his mother or Randy Nations, on island, Jack, Locke, Sawyer, etc. And even someone like Jacob, he has to, like, create a figurehead. This is one of the first times that Hurley admits, I am not following someone else's instincts, I'm following my own. And the fact that it turns out successful, I think, plays immediately into the fact that, yeah, he can lead. He has done small things in the past, like everything going on with the food, but there's a difference between, like, becoming a micromanager, you know, a small-time leader, and becoming a big-time leader in that regard. And I think Hurley is slowly realizing that there isn't someone that he needs to necessarily follow. He can be the one to let people follow.
I also just love the line, how do you break the ice with the smoke monster?
It's a good question.
Yeah.
Well, we learned, so you don't stab him.
Don't stab him. No, I mean, that kind of broke the ice. It seemingly worked for the smoke monster's benefit.
I suppose so. Do you try any classic icebreakers, like, my name is Hurley and I'm bringing hamburgers to the picnic, your turn?
You throw a shoe at him, and he picks up the shoe, and he's now chosen you to talk about. I think is how that works.
Or you do, okay, you step in a circle and you do your superhero identity.
Let me tell you one you don't do. Trust falls.
Very much so, especially with someone who is porous smoke.
Yeah.
You go right through him.
You don't do trust falls with the smoke monster. How do you break the ice with the whispers? We are about to find out as Hurley hears the whispers, goes off in pursuit, and wants to talk to Michael Sound 5.
Hey, you around? Michael!
Stuck on the island, aren't you?
Because of what I did.
And there are others out here like you, aren't there? That's what the whispers are?
Yeah. We're the ones who can't move on.
Do you know where Locke is?
No.
Is there anything I can do to help you?
Don't get yourself killed.
Okay.
And Hurley, if you ever do see Libby again,
mm-hmm.
I'm very sorry.
I'll be sure and do that, dude.
That is a series wrap on Michael Dawson, folks.
I really this is maybe the scene from the final season that has aged the best for me in terms of where it was at the start. I really remember getting a good hate into this back in the day. And like, I actually really like that scene now. It's weird how you know, stop me if you've heard Lost meets you where you are. I think it's a really, really emotionally effective scene for me from Hurley, who has every reason in the world to hate this guy. He killed Libby, you know, for, you know, reasons that we know the fuller picture of the show. Mm-hmm. And like,
and the last time he saw Michael, Michael had betrayed him and turned him into exactly. The others as well to leave the island.
You know, he has every reason in the world to loathe this guy. And instead, he meets him with such empathy in this moment. He sees how far he's fallen. He's a ghost. He can't move on. He's stuck like this. And he is, he's talking to him. He's asking him if there's anything he can do. That's like that when he says, is there anything I can do to help you? Is a priority for Hurley to articulate in this moment. And Michael's response too of just don't get yourself killed. I don't know why this guts me so much, but it really, like, I have tears in my eyes right now, which is weird, but
in response to a Michael scene of all things,
it really does hit me, of, you know, just sort of almost unnecessary kindness that Hurley displays here. And still the deep sorrow that, you know, I think that many of us, like, an idea of hell is having to exist forever with your regrets. And that seems to be what's happening to Michael here. And I think it is so shitty that that happens to Michael, and that there's no signifier that he gets to move on in the canonical way, other than if you're able to make leaps past the new man in charge with Walt. But there's just no hide nor hair of him or Walt in the sideways. When other people like Ben get to go there, you know what I mean? Like, I think that I have taken pretty harshly with Michael specifically, and have thought that that's kind of bullshit. But I think that there is still a powerful story to be told here, that Harold Perrineau, in the limited capacity that he's used here, maybe it's just some of, you know, a lot of the hard stuff that we have all had to endure, both, you know, sort of globally and in this shared species wide way of the last several years. But also, I think a lot of the personal stuff that people go through individualistically, that certainly for me, I think that this feels resonant, this idea of like the fear of am I always going to live in feeling like I messed things up irreversibly? Will I die and still be around haunted by that shame and regret? And will there be anyone who can absolve me or at least be kind to me? Like, I think that there's a lot of humanity in this scene. So forget the answer, you know, forget what the whispers are. Take that completely out of it. And I think that this is a really impactful conversation. At least it hits me pretty hard. I really, really like it. I think that both Jorge Garcia and Harold Perrineau are really, really great in this scene.
Forget the Answer is also a nice subtitle for, you know,
for Lost season 6. Yeah.
Yeah. Or just Lost in general, right? Yeah. Of like, it's not about the answers. I mean,
let the mystery
of that,
be. Yeah.
Yeah. But so, I mean, so I agree that the scene itself, I think, is really interesting. Say what you want about the explanation, but I love you. You vocalize really beautifully the perspectives with which Hurley and Michael come through here. This might also be a reason why Hurley is able to see ghosts, right? It's like, hey, you know what? Maybe ghosts were talking the entire time, but Hurley was the only one to listen. The fact that, like, he's the only one that could lend the ear. He was charitable enough. I don't think any other character in the show would ask a ghost, is there anything you need me to do?
I'm trying to think of who else would maybe do that. Like, you would want to think maybe John Locke sometimes, but I don't know. You know, he would come to her to Claire with the crib on her birthday and stuff like that. So he had these moments where he would check in with people. But I think if he started talking to a ghost, all of his energy would go to, it's all happening for a reason, I got to chase this down the line, and not really like the empathy piece of it. And I'm trying to think of who else. Yeah, I think maybe Desmond. I don't know. I really think it's Hurley. I think Hurley makes the most sense in this regard.
Which maybe, you know, if we're talking about timey-wimey-ness is a reason why he gets these powers in the first place. So the emotionality of this scene, I agree, I enjoy it. It's also a nice way to have these two guys sort of talk to each other amidst very different planes. I would say, this is very odd to say, I would have liked to see more whispers. I find it odd that they make one appearance at the beginning of the episode and one appearance here. I think three is a magic number. It would have been nice to have it another time. But also, I would say in general, it would have been nice to have more, to the point where I forgot they showed up in the season six premiere. I think this, while, again, there is some interesting character stuff going on with this scene, I think the overall tone of their intention behind it, it's less so like, let's make a big cathartic moment around these two men, and more so like, all right, well, we're checking this box. People wanted to know what the whispers are. We're doing this thing and we're moving forward. So I'm happy that they accomplished it. But I would say that I feel like there is a way it could have been done that brings even more power to the scene.
Can I offer a placement for additional whispers in the final season?
Yes, please do.
So let's cut to the end and let's cut to the final fight cliffside between Jack and John. And John has the knife. He's already stabbed Jack and he's about to plunge it into Jack's neck before he's shot by Kate, right? Let's have him not get shot by Kate right away, and let's have the whispers clock in. And now John Loki, who's mortal all of the sudden, is for the first time scared of the dead, and that signifies that Hurley and Kate and Sawyer and Ben have just shown up, and Kate shoots him there.
I really love that idea, because it also reminds me a bit of like the climax of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, of like, do those whispers maybe not necessarily represent these characters literally, but like, it also represents Jin and Sun and Saeed and all the temple people, right? Like, the fact that his past is coming back to haunt him in the form of these whispers, I think, is a really cool idea.
Yeah, and then maybe even, like, see the ghosts could be really cool on the rocks, you know? Get Jin, get Sun, get Saeed, get all of those people there. Get Michael, you know, get his... Like, that would be a great place to showcase a lot of the actors who had previously been on the show, who died on the island. Could be really, really, really cool. But I think, I think it's stuff like that, and we talked earlier about they decided that the smoke monster can't shapeshift anymore. These, I feel like, were, you know, missed opportunities for the show. Like, you have these things mythologically at your disposal. Why are we cutting them off? You know, what's the reason for that?
This is another, again, Harry Potter reference. Apologies for all of them. Could it be something as well where I don't want to, like, add anything to the final sequence of the show, but, like, could there be something where as Jack is... you know, walking through the bamboo forest to lay him down to rest, it's not, maybe we don't get the whispers, but maybe that's a way you bring in those dead characters, almost like walking alongside him, you know, to like guide him to his final resting place, the people that were so important to him, that he ended up saving in a manner of speaking, or worked to save, that they're the ones that help lead him to where he needs to go.
I think if we didn't do the sideways, yeah, but I think with the sideways, you get that. I think it's helpful there. But I also don't want to, like, Vincent has one job
before he turns into a shih tzu.
What if a small army of shih tzus show up, but they all have faces that vaguely look like characters from Lost who died? So it's like the Boone shih tzu, the Shannon shih tzu.
That's the Uncanny Valley.
Antonio Mazzaro does an incredible thing. This is a total non sequitur, where he every once in a while will send me a text message and it's just a picture of a dog whose face looks like Top Chef winner Joe Flam. And it is hilarious and it cracks me up every time. So I just love the idea of dogs whose faces look reminiscent of former Lost characters. I think would be great.
Be certainly a way to end the show. Yeah. I think maybe less regard of like, man, that was a beautiful ending. Why did a bunch of dogs with people's faces come out of the jungle?
And then everybody walked away from May whatever 2010. It's like, wow, the Lost finale was awesome. Universal
this is
agreement.
The one thing that needed fixing. There needed more dogs with human faces in it.
All right, so we're on the other side of that. I already said my piece on the explanation of the whispers and why that's fine with me. I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that or if you're good to move on.
No, this is, again, I think something I've largely,
you don't really care about.
Come to peace with. Yep. I think there's an explanation of it. Like I said, it's more so like, I'm fine with it. I wish it could have been shoehorned in a little bit better.
Yeah.
I think it makes sense in the Hurley episode, and it was a box to check, and it's an interesting explanation, but like we just talked about, could have been more fun ways to pepper in this idea of the dead haunting the island over the course of the show. Yeah,
this could have set something up, and it doesn't. That's the thing that I would still say is like, okay, I wish that we'd done more, but I don't mind what it is. I think what it is totally fine. And the scene in which it's presented, I think, is actually really good. Let's go to another good scene. It's the wake up. Hurley's going to wake up. Hurley and Libby on the date. Sound number 6.
I got like 6 different kinds of cheeses. I don't even know what they are, but the lady at the store said they were good, so... I think you like cheese because everybody likes cheese. Something wrong?
No, not wrong. Just off.
Have you been here before?
No. It's just being here with you feels so familiar. It's like a date we never had. Wow, I sound completely insane, don't I?
No. Not completely.
Why do you even want to be with me?
Why do you want to be with me?
What?
Come on, look at me.
I want to be with you because I like you.
Yeah, but... you like me because... you're delusional.
Desmond pulling the Leonard Nimoy in Marge vs. the Monorail. Yeah. I'm like, well, my work here is done.
Yeah, I love... well, he's like, oh, great. He woke up. Well, time to go run over John Locke.
Well, push up my sunglasses and stain them with blood. Yeah! It's time to run over a man.
Yeah. So that's what he's going to go and do. We got to hear the wake-ups, right? I think that's important. We want to listen to those. As they happen.
And speaking of which, so this was suggested when we watched the episode along, and I think we agreed upon it. So let's bring it to the forefront, Josh. I think we need a counter for the season 6 wake-ups, much like we had with the Benjamin Linus beatdowns and the Kate Austin aliases. I think, especially as we get into the end, I think it makes sense for us to power rank the wake-ups to see where they stack up.
Okay, so we've got 2 so far then, right? We've got Hurley and we've got Desmond are now both awake. And what are we qualifying as Desmond's wake up? Because I think that, you know, he has the moment in the MRI, but that doesn't fully wake him up.
Right, but I wouldn't say that Charlie holding his hand up wakes him up.
No,
either.
But what about Desmond shakes Penny's hand? That's where he wakes up, right? You know, so he doesn't really have a montage that is associated with the actual wake up. So it's a little unfair. I guess he gets an episode, effectively, is what he gets.
The episode long wake up. Either way, whatever you appropriate, I think it's better than the Hurley one.
I do too. I actually think that, you know, I think that there are 3 contenders for the worst wake up. And it's going to be, just by default, it's going to be Desmond and Hurley and then Saeed's. You know, I think those are going to be
Saeed's, the circumstances, right?
Those will be the three that are at the bottom of the list. And then it's like a race for the top spot. And I have my personal answer having watched the finale the other day. But we'll talk about it when we get there and that'll be fun. I do think that, you know, the totality of the wake-ups and that journey for Desmond in Happily Ever After is stronger than Hurley's moment with Libby. It's just not as, I don't know, for whatever reason, it's not quite as emotionally impactful as the other ones. And I think part of it is because it's not tied to the event of the finale. You know, it's taking place in this episode, and it's nice to have him fully awake for the entirety of the finale. But I do think that we maybe miss a little bit of the emotional resonance when Hurley wakes up. At least that's how I feel.
No, I don't disagree. That, again, this is one of those pieces of the episode that I'm like, this should feel more heartwarming, but it's like, fine. Actually, more so like the scene leading up to it. Very reminiscent to me of the climax of Dave, right? Where Hurley's standing on the cliff and he says, like, of course you're not real, because why would someone like you want to be with someone like me? I like the reflection of that. But I would say that I agree that I think this will probably end up on the bottom. I think that really the matter of it as well, and this actually connects back to the Shannon Saeed thing, is that we saw Libby for what, a snatch of episodes in season two. And that's it. It is not nearly as impactful a moment from a lost character perspective as nearly any of the other wake-ups. I think, unfortunately, it's just due to the fact that we didn't see that much of Libby. It's like, great, good for Hurley. He obviously loves Libby, still thinking about her even all these years later. But the fact of the matter is, like, okay, Libby's involved. You know, even the montage we get of their scenes is probably like all the scenes they had together. They actually didn't have that much time together over the course of Lost Season 2. So it's a little bit of like acknowledging something that was not incredibly strong from a character perspective, at least not compared to, obviously, Jin and Sun, Sawyer and Juliet, John Locke wiggling his toes, even like Claire, Aaron, Charlie, and Kate is another big one. So unfortunately, I think just from a content perspective, this one does not necessarily provide those feels.
Yeah, I think so. I agree. But he's awake, and that's nice. And he will be an ally to Desmond in the Flash Sideways. And it'll be fun to have him sort of in that mode for some of these characters in the end. You get to see a little bit of post-finale Hurley in the finale, if that makes sense. Sideways Hurley, you get a sense of what he was like after everybody left the island. So that stuff is good. I'm glad that it happened. Okay, so Locke and Desmond reach the well, and we get a little bit of backstory and history and John Loki pretending to be a good guy until he finally reveals that he's not such a good guy, and it culminates in another incredible Desmond scream. Let's listen in sound 7.
What is it?
It's a well. Let me guess. You're wondering how deep it is.
You read my mind.
You have any idea how old this well is, Desmond?
Very old.
That's exactly right. Very old. So old, in fact, that the people who dug this well did it completely by hand. God knows how long it took them.
That seems like a lot of work just to get some water.
Oh, they weren't looking for water. They were looking for answers. A long time ago, places like the one we're standing at right now made compass needles spin. And the people holding the compasses needed to know why. So they dug.
Did they find what they were looking for?
No, they didn't. The reason I wanted you to see this, Desmond,
is because Charles Widmore is not interested in answers. He's only interested in power. And he brought you back to this island so that you could help him find what he's looking for. After all, this isn't the only well.
And that's the reason you wanted me to see this.
Why aren't you afraid?
Excuse me.
You're out here, middle of the jungle, with me. Not a person on Earth even knows you're here. Why aren't you afraid?
What is the point in being afraid?
Do you think they just took his scream from last episode and added reverb onto it? They're like, HIC, you don't need to do it again. We'll just loop it. It's almost like a more aggressive version of what Ben does when he's on the camel.
It's a... Wow, that camel starts blitzing after that.
Oh, shit! Oh, God! Something's gotta be going on.
Unbelievable. Who needs Saul when you've got John Loki to drill into our heads how much of a metaphor this is, right? People came to places like these to find answers, but they never found what they were looking for, those suckers. Mm-hmm. You talking to me? Who are you talking to, John Loki? You talking to me?
Yeah. Also, a little bit of that too, and like, well, how deep do you think it goes?
Right.
That's where also I think that the Desmond is a child stuff comes to mind for me. Of like, how old is this well? Very old. That mm-hmm. sounds like something a 5-year-old kid would ask in response.
Yes. I don't mind that conceptually, and I certainly think when I, we talk about this, for me, like when I recommend Lost to people, I'm like, don't worry about the answers. Care about the characters in the story and the journey and the location and the music and the acting and all that stuff. And that's the stuff. And so this idea here of they went looking for answers and they never found it. And sort of the unspoken piece of that being like, and shame on them for looking for the wrong thing. I get that. That's fine. But it also does feel a little contrary to a lot of the energy around the show up to that point. It almost feels like a little bit of a late arrival.
There's also a little bit of confusion here. So we're like, again, at this point, we on the podcast have sort of discerned what side Charles Widmore's on. But now John Loki's confusing the waters by being like, no, but Charles Widmore only wants power. When that very much isn't true.
Widmore's place in this is just so wobbly.
Yeah, it really is. It's like he is technically on the same side as 815, but is still Widmore at the end of the day. So like very much not. So, and you do wonder maybe he was coming to the island to get its power in a manner of speaking. It's odd. And obviously this is, I think no matter what, this is a con by Loki's part, right? To be like, you want to work with me because doesn't Charles Widmore suck? Yeah, you want to be part of my crew because we hate Charles Widmore. In fact, we want to kill Charles Widmore one day.
Yeah. It's just very strange. But I do love just getting a classic sort of like that Terry O'Quinn, John Lockean wisdom, even if it's not actually him. It's just kind of a pleasure to watch the scene is sort of my feeling on it.
I like the moment where a really fun Desmond moment of enlightenment, right? Again, another reason why kids are often like the sanest among us of, what's the point in being afraid? And you see John Loki makes a look of confusion that Jan transitions to a smile of like, oh, okay. I'm just going to throw you down a well.
Well, yeah, I think of Desmond saying to the smoke monster, what's the point of being afraid, is like Jacob saying to Ben, what about you? That only ends one way. I mean, I guess two ways. Either you get stabbed or you get thrown down a well. But either way, it ends in violence. It ends in a violent response.
Yeah, so Desmond's going to hang out down there for what, a couple episodes until Saeed comes and finds him?
Desmond will be down the well effectively for the rest of Lost until the finale and all the sideways stuff. Yeah. He will, they will go looking for him in what they died for, but they won't find him there. And he will be seen again outside. We will see him in the well next week.
Yes, then when Saeed is sent to sort of finish the job, yes, and he relents.
We will see him there. We will not see him in The Candidate outside of The Sideways. We will not see him in What They Died For outside of The Sideways. And then we will see him again on his own two feet in The End. Otherwise, down the hatch goes Desmond once again, subterranean Desmond.
Which I guess I like that symbology, but yeah, like you said, it still does bring to mind, especially when we see the plan, I guess, be completed next episode, why the plan was to do that, to throw Desmond, because again, he was very much willing to go along with JL as the smoke monster here. If you have to kill him off, surely there are more ceremonious ways to do so and guarantee a clean victory than throwing him down a well and letting Saeed finish him off.
I don't know. Maybe it's because of his electromagnetic stuff that maybe the monster is nervous to touch him too much. I don't know. I'm not entirely sure why he doesn't just kill him. I don't think his name is on a wall. I don't really know. He probably should have just killed Desmond and spared himself some agony. Anyway, so that's what happens. John Loki comes back, and when he comes back, you know, Sawyer's doing a lot of this, where were you? And like at this point, it's clear that the trust has dissolved between these guys. So I don't know why they're both playing along anymore.
Poor Sawyer, right? Like he was instituted as this recruit in Recon, right? To like go on this mission. Saeed has very clearly usurped him. You know, Jin was sent on it, was sort of being recruited as well. Kate was being talked to. Now, Desmond sort of leapfrogged him. And so Sawyer's like, please give me something to do in this show right now. I'm doing nothing at the moment.
Yep. And so in walks Hurley, and Hurley has figured out how to break the ice with the smoke monster. Let's listen in.
Hey. Hello, Hugo. I don't know who you are, dude. Or what you want. But we have to talk to you.
We?
There are other people with me. The thing is, you got weapons and we got weapons. And I don't want anyone to get hurt. Or killed. So, we're not going to do anything. I want you to worry that you're not going to do anything either.
You have my word.
Okay, guys. Come on out.
Hello, Jack.
Drop your buffs.
Yeah, we are merged.
Drop the pieces of Alana still on you.
It's a cool scene. I like it. I love Hurley stepping up, and I love the man in black offering the knife to Hurley. I just think that the whole vibe, like this is kind of what you're waiting for. Whether or not they connect it all the way for the next couple of episodes is taste dependent, but you know, why did we take so long to intermingle? You know, we want these flavors together. So once the flavors are together, like, it's great. This is great. This is really fun. This is a cool scene of getting everybody together, but could have done this four episodes ago.
Completely agree. It's one of these moments that I agree is really satisfying, especially the moment, just the sequence of Jack seeing Kate smiling at her and then it cutting to John Loki of like, oh yeah, these two guys have never seen each other, right? The last time Jack saw John Locke was all the way back in The Life and Death of Jeremy Bentham. Here he is now wearing a man wearing his clothing, essentially. I think now in retrospect, especially looking upon some of those episodes that came about since Dr. Linus, I think it took too long.
Yeah.
I think it absolutely did. I think there is some sort of recut, not recon, of the intervening five or so episodes that has these two groups coming together sooner to give some more time to some of these dynamics or just shorten the season up a little bit. Doesn't take away, like you said, from like the cool climactic aspects. Arguably, I think this should have been the ending over the next scene we're going to talk about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we will talk more about the aftermath of all of these people coming together next week. So I think we can just drive straight ahead for the sideways where Desmond's at the school where Dr. Linus works and substitute teacher John Locke. And he's looking at John Locke and Dr. Linus rolls up. Creeps smell their own kind, I guess.
What if this is the moment, this is how Ben woke up? He's like, he sees another creep and like he sees a montage of like all the times he was creepy to Juliet and other people.
Yeah, exactly.
Dude, whoa.
Whoa. Oh my God, it's another creep. My constant. Ben's like, get out of here, you creep. And Desmond's like, all right.
Stop perving around this high school, dude.
Yeah, no more pervs. And so Desmond's like, all right, I'll leave. And he leaves by driving straight into John Locke and just fully bodies John Locke. The body just goes flying. It is physically harrowing.
It's physically harrowing, but I will admit the shot right before he gets hit is laughable. particularly the expression on Terry O'Quinn's face, which is no expression. If you don't remember, it's a shot where the camera closes in on him to mimic the car. Terry O'Quinn puts his arms up, but has no expression on his face whatsoever, like you might when you're about to get hit by a car. He somehow physically reacts, but his face does not.
Yeah, but then he's just twitching on the ground and not in terms of live streaming. And it is brutal. It's just like a horrible thing. It's kind of miraculous that he makes it out of the hospital next week. Or is it the candidate where he gets out? Either way, I mean, he pulls through with flying colors.
Yeah, he got hit by a car at a pretty fair speed, I would say.
I guess if you're going to get hit by a car at that speed, you want to already be dead. You want to already be a ghost, and maybe that lessens the impact to a certain extent. I guess
a good point is John Locke quite literally felt half the pain that someone else might due to his circumstances.
Yes, I think that's right. All right, so that is how Everybody Loves Hugo ends. What a strange ending.
It's
for
a really
this episode.
Weird ending. Yeah. I guess it's again supposed to like move forward, like, oh man, things are getting intense in the Flash sideways, but I feel like you said the anticipation for the merging of the groups is finally here. I think it stands up on its own that we don't necessarily need the big shock of, oh my God, is Locke dead? Even though he technically is already dead.
Yeah. All right. So we are going to rate this episode on a scale of 0 to 4.2 fish biscuits when we come back. We also have a little bit of feedback to get through, plus the MVP, LVPs. We'll throw it to our sponsors real quick and get to it when we get back. Hang tight.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy Nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
Do you have weak, damaged hair? New Garnier Fructis hair filler systems fill hair with strength 7 layers deep. In just one use, you can reverse up to 1 year of damage to hair smoothness. The sulfate-free hair filler plus vitamin CG system gives you up to 79% stronger hair and up to 4 times less breakage. New Garnier Fructis hair filler is available now on Amazon and at Walmart, Target, Ulta, Drug, and select grocery stores.
All All right, Mike, let us rate this episode. Everybody Loves Hugo, which is an episode I mostly really enjoy. And I think that there are a lot of great scenes. And I think I was higher on it even last week than I was this week when I revisited it again during the live watch and even talking some of it through and getting re-triggered by the Alana stuff. I look at some of the other episodes from across this season, and it's, for me, it's certainly a lot better than some of the really low-tiered, low-ranked episodes right. of the season. Just, like, not even close. But it's I have to be just, like, honest to what is on screen, despite, you know, my heart telling me that it's a Hurley episode, and I tend to really, really love those episodes. That while there are good things in this one, I think it's not quite as good as I want it to be, and there are some mistakes that are not necessarily catastrophic is such a big word, but I think things in here that I don't understand why they are here. So I'm going to give it a 3.5 is where I'm going to land. I had it higher before, but it can't be as high as Happily Ever After, I don't think, which I gave a 3.8. And it's not quite as good as, you know, the emotional high of Dr. Linus even. So it's just like a smidge below that for me. Gave it a 3.5.
Yeah, I am sort of in the same range as you. I gave it a 3.2, which is actually the same score I gave Sundown. I think we actually both gave the same scores to Sundown. And honestly, that feels right, of like there are a couple of really good pieces, but then there are a lot of things that I don't necessarily care for. I sort of compared it back to the episode of the exact opposite name, Everybody Hates Hugo, which I gave a 3.1. And I think I like this episode slightly more, because like you said, there are some character-rich scenes that I enjoy. But I would not say there's anything that I'm, like, over-the-top in love with, like some of the stuff I experienced in, like, Abaterno and even some stuff in Happily Ever After. I think the on-island stuff can border on interesting with the Michael and Hurley stuff to just unpalatable with the Alana stuff. And everything else in between, like, everything with John Loki and Desmond is, I guess, interesting, but, like, not something that necessarily piques my attention, especially after that Desmond Powerhouse episode and Everybody Loves Hugo. And on that note, I think that the Sideways, it's a little bit of a come down, obviously, from Happily Ever After. It's a little bit of a come down. I think it's good, but I think, as we talked about before, I still don't know how to sit with, like, Hurley's wake-up moment being Libby. I'm happy for him, but it's such a thing from so long ago that I do wonder, you know, is it really not hitting home because it's been so long since we've really encountered that part of Hurley's life, as we'll talk about with Saeed and Shannon. So I think I like this a smidge more than Everybody Loves or Everybody Hates Hugo. So that gets a 3.2 from me overall. So again, like in my good episode tier, certainly better than, as I mentioned before, about half the episodes in season 6 so far. I think that's where it's going to rank, right? Like right at the top of the bottom half.
It is. Yeah, it's right at the top of the bottom half. Right now it lands in 7 with a 3.5 average from the audience, gives it a 3.41. So it is just ahead of Sundown. And so, yeah, it's right in that spot between Sundown and Dr. Linus, which I think is ultimately, maybe, yeah. I don't know, if that feels mostly right. I don't know, ranking the final season is a little tricky.
It's weird because each episode, it's almost like, again, back to season 1, where I felt like each episode was almost like of its own different quality. Like, there is a through line throughout, but each episode feels so distinctly different that it's tough to rank them against each other. Also, I will give a shout out to Daniel Brennan, who gave Everybody Loves Hugo a 4.2.
Yeah.
I'm not going to yuck anyone's yum. If this episode makes you feel good things, go ahead, through with it.
You know, Down Servo was really high on it as well. We had a lot of people who were really high on it. You know, 3.8s, 3.7s. It gets as low as a, what's the lowest that it goes?
A 2.8.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, it's at least, you know, a base hit, the episode. It's not a disaster. It has maybe a disastrous thing happen. But, you know, is the episode itself a full-on disaster? I would say no, definitely not. No. I would say that the episode is much more good than bad. And as somebody who, you know, swears up and down fealty to Trisha Tanaka is dead, I am never going to be the person who says that, you know, undying fealty to a Hurley episode is wrong. do that, whichever one it is for you. If it's Everybody Loves Hugo, that's great. Let's do some feedback, Mike. Some of it we actually already did throughout the podcast, but we've got a few others that we did not get into, such as this from Eric Divestein, the Birthday King, who says that killing Alana in Arstian fashion is not great, and I won't elaborate on it because I'm sure you'll be discussing it in detail anyway. However, if there's a redeeming element of it, perhaps it's that it proved the island's endorsement and support of Hurley's plan. Hurley insisted that they should not blow up the plane, but Alana wouldn't change course, so the island blew her up. I disagree with Ben's statement that the island killed her because it was done with her. I think it killed her because she opposed the island's will.
I mean, yeah, I suppose so. It's weird to like have the island represented because, again, we thought that was mostly through Jacob, and Jacob is now sort of gone. I guess it makes sense that, you know, Alana dies essentially professing this idea, and so you'd assume like, well, she blew up and she was talking about how good of an idea it was, so maybe it isn't. It's just, I think, for me, tough to separate what the island truly wants, considering that I think its greatest envoy is not necessarily speaking on its behalf a lot of the time.
Yeah. Ben Martell, in response to the story about the Kitsis and Horowitz appearance in Wisconsin, Madison, had asked us, can we retcon a reason why Alana would have made things too easy for the characters?
I mean, you mentioned it before, like, is it just as easy as she's on the sub, she makes the sacrifice play and takes the bomb, and that makes things, quote-unquote, too easy for them?
Yeah, or if she knows a lot via Jacob about the island, maybe there are just, you know, cheat codes that she can arm everybody with, but I don't know. They're fighting the smoke monster. We don't want to give them an edge. You don't want to give them proton packs, you know? I think maybe you do. You know, if we're going to, we don't have to, you know, go all the way into giving them, like the Hurst, the Ecto-1 or whatever. Mm-hmm. But give them some proton packs if Alana knows where those are. Like if she knows where the trap door is within the aero station, hell yeah. Let's see that.
That's the thing is that, I guess they're sort of, explanation with that is that they wanted the characters to sort of figure out things on their own.
But they don't really.
Yeah, exactly. They don't really. Jacob is going to appear from beyond the grave to be like, no, go to this place, drink this water. So I think like it doesn't not make sense to have Alana there if the purpose is like, well, we don't want to handhold these characters. I'd much rather have that than have them sit around for more episodes trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there was more to do with the character. Even in what they died for, you know, she could make the choice that now is the time to have Jacob show up one last time because she has the ashes and she puts them in the fire, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, she has to sacrifice the final vestige of being able to see this father figure so that the candidates can hear from the source and find out what it is they have to do. Something like that. I don't know. There was just more to do. There was definitely more to do with the character if they were going to have her on the show at all. It was just, you know, I don't know. Whatever. I'm sour. I'm salty about it. Dallin Cervo had asked us, where's David Reyes in The Flash Sideways? I think we answered that question. And Dallin had also written in and asked, did the show miss an opportunity to give us a definitive answer for why Libby was in the mental hospital? We easily could have had the doctor explain why she was there. Oh yeah, Dr. Brooks, if you're already going to be taking bribes, can you please breach doctor patient confidentiality as well?
Yeah, in for a penny, in for a pound, and he has many, many pennies.
We also got an additional 5 dudes in this episode, which is low for a Hurley episode. Yeah. According to Dallin, 285 dudes.
Now I'm actually doubting if we're going to get to 300 by the end.
I know.
Because we only have, what, 4 episodes left?
We have The Last Recruit, The Candidate, What They Died For, The End, and The New Man in Charge, if we're counting that.
Oh, yeah, New Man in Charge. I guess that does count. That could help bring it up. Because, yeah, I can't remember. Because Hurley is now, his role in The Flash Sideways is going to be like, you know, the money man to help Desmond succeed in his stuff. But I don't remember that much stuff we see from him. He's not going to be as happy to throw dudes out there, I think, in the episodes to come on Ireland as well. So, yeah, it might be a bit of a horse race here in the finish.
All right, let's do the 23 points. Mike, I've got 3 MVPs this week. You've got 2. You've got 3 LVPs. I've got 2. We are all over the place on the MVPs. I'm going to start with Hurley. Hurley's great. Everybody loves Hugo. What more do you want me to say?
It's a great episode for Hurley. It's him taking charge as well as him waking up. And I'm going to give a point to the person who wakes him up, much like I did with Charlie last week. I'm going to give a point to Libby here. really great to see Cynthia Watros back to reprise her role. I think she has great scenes with Jorge Garcia, and she is the one to push Hurley to wake up, which is a seminal moment for the character.
Yes. I'm going to give an MVP point to Michael, the plant, the ghost plant, the haunted forest that is Michael Dawson. I really love seeing him back on this show. I think that they do a good job with him here. I think that they really do. I think that his scene with Hurley is really touching. It really moved me this time, even just listening to it again on the podcast today. I think he's a character that gets maligned in the fandom quite a bit. It's not totally unwarranted because of what he does is very, very bad. It's very, 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 very bad. But can you not tell that the man feels awful about it? Has he not suffered? You know, the whole thing is really, really, really rough. And Harold Perrineau is just great. And he was one of the first easy ins on Lost for me in the first place. You know, having loved him so dearly from Oz and other projects, that Harold Perrineau was the actor who was the actor for me on Lost coming into this show in many, many real ways. So for his final appearance, I would feel remiss if I did not give him an MVP point.
Yes, plants out for you, yes. Michael. I'm going to give a point here. I was originally going to give one to Richard Alpert for calling Hurley out on his shit, but you know what? I'm going to give one to Jack. Because let's continue on the train here of, like, Jack just being, like, a generally good dude in this episode. And I really like that therapy scene for him where he vocalized how he realized that he does actually need to do what Boone told him to do all those years ago and learn to let go and stop trying to fix things. And the fact that he's willing to stick with Hurley and go with his gut no matter... You know, he trusted Hurley when Hurley doesn't even trust himself, I think is a super good friend move. So I'm going to continue to throw the points onto Jack here.
I have one final MVP point, and considering everything I've said on this podcast already, I don't think it should come as a surprise that I'm going to give it to Alana in her death episode. It's not her fault. It's not your fault, Alana. This one's not on you. What a change in my etiquette for what happens when people die on the show. But I can't do it. I can't do it to Alana. She's been through enough. I think that she's so nice to Hurley at the start of the episode. She was very effective in many, many ways along the way. And I think that there was more to do. And I think that was a really, really cheap and not in the Ryan Aiken sense way of sending Alana off into the great graveyard in that lost sky. So Alana gets an MVP point from me.
Do you think Alana was able to move on, or do you think she's a whisper as well?
Probably a ghost. You blow up, you're a ghost.
Yeah, to be like, what? Why did you, Jacob, why did you tell us to do that if that's not what you wanted
and
us to do?
He's just like, oh, sorry.
So we should note here, Alana has two MVP points because I believe she did get one in Dr. Linus as well. And considering I think she did get a couple in season 5 too. Like, Alana, despite being a fairly, I would say, maligned character in the spectrum of Lost, is going to make a good handful of points here in DTH at the end of the day.
Good for her. Well deserved. Totally deserved. Absolutely.
All right, well, speaking of those who deserve it in a different way, let's go to the LVPs. I've got 3. You've got 2. I got to start with this one. It sucks to do after last episode. I'm giving one to Desmond.
Yeah, double tap. I'm doing one on Desmond as well.
Well, I think 2 is appropriate because I think 1 should be for Sideways Desmond for hitting a man with his car. And the other one should be with On Island Desmond for being so supple to have John Loki throw him down a well.
Yeah, he got tricked. He got too close to the sun. Desmond did.
Sun just showed up. Then he was after he was down the
that's
well.
Right.
Unfortunately,
he got too close to the well. Oh well,
a different source of light, maybe.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna give my second point here. I'm gonna give one to Dr. Brooks.
Double tap.
Double tap, Dr. Brooks.
Yeah, whatever.
Sucks.
You know, just few options in this episode, and I don't like them.
Yeah, he also allows himself to get bought. Hurley could have gone in and, like, stabbed Libby, and the blood would have literally been on Dr. Brooks' hand for letting this guy pay his way into doing that thing.
And he would have $100,000 from Hurley to go towards his legal defense.
Exactly, which would probably be that stupid guy from the first part of season 5, whatever his name was, Dan something.
Yes.
I'm going to give my last point. I don't know if that's controversial. Dan Norton, that's what it was. I'm giving one to John Loki. Here it was.
I couldn't do it because at least John Loki like successfully conned Desmond into going to the well.
The con doesn't make a lot of sense. And also, I maybe it's also a residual LVP point for the fact that he has literally just been sitting there for like 5 episodes at this point. He briefly visited Hydra Island and then he came back, but maybe it's also my pent up frustration Sawyer style of like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
But you're just sitting there carving a stick. Just do something. You're a cool smoke monster. Do something, please.
Yeah, I totally hear that. I mean, the bottom is falling out on the John Loki stuff at this point. The best of John Loki is behind us for sure. It's just not even a question. All right, so that is so with those scores, I'm trying to see what are some of the meaningful shifts. Jack is still in the lead. Jack has
but
6 MVPs.
Yeah, because Hurley's at 5. I'm assuming Hurley's probably going to net, if we do MVP LVPs for The Man Behind the Curtain, you got to imagine Hurley nets a fair amount of them. So there is a chance we might get a little bit of an overtake at the end here. But yeah, Jack continues to be in the lead here, while Smokey continues to fall. He is now tied with the man he now inhabits, John Locke, with 3 points for this season.
Yeah, I think he's going to continue to fall much as he does at the end of the show. Potentially as soon as next week, we will get some Smokey demerits as we get into the last recruit. A bit of a forgettable episode of Lost, but one that I've always enjoyed. I think I have to stop short of saying, this is a great episode. This is an incredible episode. But I think it's an underrated episode because people just forget it. It is what I think you will call something of a nothing burger, Mike, and is definitely like chess pieces. But I love seeing my people interacting with each other. And you get that in this one. And it's been way too long since we've seen these characters interact with one another, so it scratches a certain itch for me. It's got an adventure vibe to it, a lot of moving bits and pieces as they're trying everybody to get the hell out of your conflicting agendas, so there's a lot of fun stuff, but there's also some stupid stuff in The Last Recruit as well, but I have a personal attachment to it. This was when I was covering the show for MTV News at the time. I was able to do like a live blog for The Last Recruit for ABC.com.
Oh, wow.
So this will always be an episode. This was like the closest to the sun that I flew, and the gin that I flew, with Lost in any kind of a professional capacity was like during these days of the show, where I got to do some fun stuff for MTV. So The Last Recruit's going to be a special one for me personally. I don't think it'll totally, impact my ratings there. Like, I'm not going to be a psycho and give it a 4.2. But I, maybe we'll be a little higher on it than other people. But I think it's a fun one. We'll talk about it next week. We will be watching that on November 29th at 8 p.m. Eastern in the Post Show Recaps Patron Campus. Sign up at patreon.com/postshowrecaps at the $5 level by the morning of November 29th. And you will be able to watch the episode alongside Mike, myself, and plenty of other hatchlings. Always a really, really fun time on those Monday night live watches. Get your feedback in as well by November 30th. We are recording on December 1st. And Mike, we are entering the final month of watching episodes of Lost for this rewatch, which is insanity.
Yeah, this is truly wild. It's one of those things that doesn't become a reality until you reach certain milestones.
We're in it. Yeah.
Yeah. For some people, it might have been starting season 6. Maybe it's crossing the threshold of something like Ab Eterno. But yeah, I marked it beforehand. We have 4 episodes and then the new man in charge. And then that's it for this watch through. It is wild to think about that this is finale month for Down the Hatch. And I'm nervous and I'm scared. Like you said, this episode is a transition into like a marked era to close out the season. And I'm excited to see what that is. And no matter what the quality of episode, much like today, we're going to have a fun time talking about it. It's just sad that we're going to have, only 4 or 5 more opportunities to talk about these specific episodes.
Wow. All right. Well, we are. We're so close. We're so close. It's going to be really, really fun getting into the home stretch here. We're at the merge, Mike. And so it's all forward momentum from here. So next week is The Last Recruit. Get your feedback in, your 4.2 fish biscuits as well. Down the Hatch at postshowrecaps.com. We would love to hear from you, and we would love to get those ratings as we are looking to do some fun stuff on the other side of the rewatch. So please send all of that in. Mike Bloom, anything else?
Yeah, so a few things going on here over on Post Show Recaps. The Bloom Files, we took a brief hiatus last week because your boy got inoculated, much like Desmond Hume, and that knocked me on my butt, much like Desmond Hume. Felt like I got knocked down a well for a little bit, but... Exactly. We are back this week, Angela and myself, talking about the first two episodes of season 8 with John Doggett, a.k.a. Robert Patrick, a.k.a. I forget his name, but Sawyer's partner who sells him out in Outlaws is appearing on the X-Files, so we're going to break that down. And I forgot to plug this last week, but I think it's still fairly evergreen. So a new season of Star Trek Discovery is here, snuck up on us a little bit, premiered November 18th on Paramount Plus. And myself and Jessica Lees, just to say it off the top here, or at the bottom, I suppose, we're doing periodic coverage of that, not weekly, but probably every few weeks or so, just due to Jess's schedule and our own respective bandwidths. Jess wasn't around last week to cover the premiere, but we wanted to bring you something. So I got together with a seminal member of the DTH team behind the scenes. This ship would not run in the way that it does without this man. Brendan Fitzpatrick, join me, who's a huge Trekkie in his own right, huge Star Wars and Star Trek fan. Everything stars, and Brendan is a star himself. We talked about the premiere of Star Trek Discovery, which actually has some recent news to it. There was some weird shadiness going on last week where they like announced the day before Star Trek premiered that it wouldn't air anywhere except Paramount Plus in the United States and some networks in Canada. But then they said, like, okay, we heard you loud and clear. You understandably complained, so it's coming back now. So now if you're an international viewer, you can watch along and watch what we're doing. Josh, though, if I'm sending the plugs over to you, I am so excited with a lot of the recent stuff that you have been bringing to post-show recaps. Mainly for me, it's been like checking out your coverage of The Wheel of Time.
Yeah.
Between Hawkeye, which I've only watched one
episode. The frozen donkey wheel of time.
Exactly. Between Hawkeye or Hurley Bird Eye, which is, I've only watched one episode of it, but I supremely love it. And especially your new Everything is Super adjacent patron-only podcast, or I guess Patreon-only podcast. You can explain a little bit of that. Extra with a capital X for your X-Men, the animated series rewatch. I remember very clearly one of the first action figures I owned was a Magneto where you push a little switch on his back and some sparks rub together to try to like light up the middle of his chest. I have that fondly implanted into my memory.
Incredible.
So I'm excited to take a jog down memory lane with you and Kevin.
Yeah, I mean, another reason to consider supporting Post-Show Recaps on Patreon is we did just launch this new podcast, Extra, which is a companion to the Everything is Super podcast, which is our superhero spot every week, where we're going to be watching the X-Men animated series and talking about other superhero shenanigans that we don't have time for in the main Everything is Super podcast, hence the Extra. And you can get it in your podcast feed if you are a patron of Post-Show Recaps. If you are not a patron of Post Show Recaps, you just got to go to patreon.com/postshowrecaps and press play on the podcast on the website. You can listen to it for free. That's the way to do it. You don't get it in your podcast feed, but we will be posting it for free on the website every single week. It's super casual, really conversational. We're not doing any editing on it. It's just very, very light and fluffy and bantery and really fun talking about a show that apparently is very near and dear to your heart, Mike, which is really cool to hear.
Yeah.
And is a show that I adored as a kid. So Kevin and I are going to be talking about X-Men on the Extra podcast.
And I should also mention, I was on Post Show Recaps Theater this past week. I slipped my mind because it technically hasn't come out yet, but I got to join Grayson and Ariel to talk about Ghostbusters Afterlife, which you actually recently invoked, Josh, on this podcast. A new film that came out, sort of like a spiritual sequel to Ghostbusters 1/Ghostbusters 2. We had a really fun time talking about it. I would say overall, it was a really unexpected movie for me in many ways. So if you want to hear a bit about it, we do a spoiler-free and then a spoiler-filled talk. So be sure to check that out. Also on post-show recaps, in addition to like the butt ton of other stuff we're doing.
There's just so much stuff. So just check it out on post-show recaps. There's so many things. It's in the main feed. Most of these shows have their own feeds as well. So just poke around, see what you like, listen to the stuff. And yeah, we're doing all the things. It's great that you talked about Ghostbusters this week during the same episode where we're dealing with ghosts on Lost, Mike.
Yes, though I wish Hurley did pull out a proton pack and just sucked up Michael. Could you imagine if that's how that scene ended?
Like,
is there something
horrible
you do for me? Like, yes, set the trap. Put me out of my misery.
I would have taken his Tyrannosaurus Rex trophy away at that point. We do want to thank everybody again for voting for us and giving us that award at the start of the show.
You know what? This is Thanksgiving, so like we are thankful in many ways. And one of them is, of course, the voting you gave us to give us what is the award? Benefactor of the Year at this fictional museum?
It's just so nice of you. It's so nice of you, and we're so grateful for you, and we hope that we will live up to the honorific that you have bestowed upon us. We will be back next week talking more Lost. Until then, everybody, take care. Bye-bye.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.